This episode is brought to you by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again. Get $100 off the Eero base unit and two beacons package and 1 year of Eero Plus. Visit eero.com/GOT and enter at checkout promo code GOT.
This podcast is also sponsored by Audible. Start listening with a 30-day Audible trial and your first audiobook plus two Audible originals are free. Visit audible.com/GOT or text GOT to 500-500.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 8, Episode 1, titled, I think, Winterfell. It was the only title I could find for it. I think it's officially on HBO now. What'd you think of the opener for the final season?
A fitting title, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the quintessential setup episode. We pretty much knew everything that was happening. You just have to wait for everyone else to catch up to where the viewer is at. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it was a thing about reunions and bringing everybody together. And, like, if you didn't have the scenes we had, like a lot of people were like, oh, nothing happened, blah, blah, blah. But if you didn't have the scenes we had, people would be like, what the fuck? Jon and Arya are going to get together and they're not going to have an emotional. So, like, you have to do it. And I think you want to do it. But, like, since the show's been off for, like, a year and a half, I see some frustration about, like, well, geez, you know, nothing happened. But I thought it was really good. There's a couple things that bothered me the first time I watched it that didn't bother me as much after I thought about it. I think I've maybe talked myself into thinking the showrunners are doing something different. We can fight about that later. Okay. There's a couple things like the Greyjoy stuff, pretty clunky. All the King's Landing stuff, I think, was pretty clunky. And they're just to check off a couple of boxes that I don't particularly care about. But overall, yeah, I thought it was pretty good. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the abbreviated season is probably going to hurt the storytelling overall. Mm-hmm. And those are some examples, some pretty good ones of just, look, we got to do this stuff, and it needs to happen so we can get to the bigger stuff that's going on. And what I think is, you know, the core tension of this season is going to be whether or not the people can come together under Dany.
Yeah.
Or at least it will be the core tension in Winterfell until this shit hits the fan with the Night King.
Yeah.
And then we'll see. Because, like, everything they're doing here, you know, they're setting up Jon as the potential true king of Westeros. They're kind of making Dany look like she could be evil with, you know, the Tarly stuff.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot of stuff here that says, is Dany worthy of being the queen?
Right.
And more importantly, is Dany worthy of having the North follow her instead of Jon? And I think that's the most interesting thing this does, and probably the most important thing. And the only thing that honestly really matters to the end of this story, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, you're going to have your characters who are going to have their emotional reunion. Some of them will die. Some of them will live. I hope some of them live anyway. It depends on what the Night King does. But ultimately, like, the fate of Westeros and who is going to rule this and what the fate of the people is going to be in general, it's most important to me, and those are the big questions that they're setting up in this episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm all in. I thought the first episode was great. Yes, they shortcut some stuff, but I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Do you want to just get into the episode, or should we?
We can.
Because there's a couple other things I just want to talk about. Like, one thing, just maybe so you can think about it, what did you think about the Dragonflight sequence on second viewing?
I had no problems with it.
No problems with it?
No.
Okay.
You got some big problems with it?
Not big problems. Just like some, the set that you and I watched it. Because the other thing is, like, the first time I watched it, as I mentioned on Instant Take podcast, is like I felt nervous that, like, you know, it's like as a fan of the show and as someone whose job is to podcast, like, my worst case nightmare is that the Double D's just completely extravagantly phoned it in, but still phoned it in, you know? And I think that they already nailed enough of the like character relationships, and that the first time I saw it, I was like, okay, well, this, there's no way that, you know, this is my last like gut check that this isn't going to be a complete fiasco. My next nervousness will be on the finale. But after I got over that, I'm like, okay, so yeah, a lot of this stuff flows a lot better. But I got to that stuff like that dragon, the Greyjoy stuff and the dragon stuff, I thought,
Just the dragon stuff, you felt it was unnecessary or just didn't look right or what?
It's like, I thought that John riding a dragon would be a bigger moment, that it would be kind of like a rite of some sort of passage, like it would go hand in hand with the knowledge he attained about he himself being a Targaryen, okay. But it's kind of like Dany is just like, she has this nice sports car. It's like flips the keys, like, hey, try it out. And John's like, and then he comes back. It's like, oh, it's super horse.
Yeah.
Nah. I mean, it's not terrible.
Okay. I get you.
And then also, when you can't, when we're how many seasons with no ghost sighting? Yeah. And we're doing a 5-minute dragon sequence with the souped up waterfall. Like, that's the other thing is I watched
really
the special.
You really spoiled me for direwolves.
Right. It's like, I used to think having a pet wolf was kind of cool. Uh-huh. Now I got a dragon named after my father I don't know about yet. Woohoo. Right. You know, that's the thing. And then also, yeah, I watched the visual effects kind of like diary that they had afterwards. And they're like, oh, we went and spent a ton of money flying to this exotic location. Mm-hmm. In this frozen wasteland, it has a waterfall, and then the Double D's wanted us to add like 3 more waterfalls to it. I'm like, can't fucking put ghosts in here. That's it. No. That's all. That's not a serious gripe about the but it's
oh yeah,
it's an honest one.
It's not cataclysmic, certainly.
Okay,
okay. Let's get into the episode proper.
Let's do it.
So before we get into the episode proper, I just wanted to talk about the intro, the new intro.
Yeah,
because there's a lot of shit in there that. Some of it I'm kind of surprised is in there.
Yeah.
Do you want to go beat by beat through
sure.
this thing? So we start off with, you know, the astrolabe and the rings that we're all used to, but they're different now. Very mm-hmm. different. They're wooden, mm-hmm. not the gold that we saw in previous seasons. We get an image of a dragon blasting down a wall. I think it's a wall. It could be a castle of some kind, but the image is very reminiscent of what we saw last season when the wall came down.
Yeah.
So I think that's what they're depicting.
I saw a pretty cleaned up version of it, and the figure that's riding atop the dragon is like the skeletal kind of gaunt. It looks like the Night King.
Okay.
So I think it's definitely suggesting of the Night King destroying the wall.
Right. And then we in that same right after that they kind of go through the hole that's now in the wall,
uh-huh.
and we see sort of the Night King's advance. We
right.
see the tiles flipping over and becoming sort of winter tiles instead mm-hmm. of just you know the regular wooden tiles they were before.
Right,
leading all the way to Last Hearth, which is sitting on interestingly a spiral type mountain,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was fitting given what we saw happen there this episode. So you can see that the intro is going to have a little bit of maybe foreshadowing in it,
yeah.
Some stuff to really analyze, which brings me to the next part, which is Winterfell.
Uh-huh.
And we see the Weirwood in the Godswood, we see the Great Hall, and we see the Crypts.
Uh-huh.
And we kind of fly through all of those. And I don't think there's anything like super interesting in there unless I missed something.
Well, there was a lot of emphasis on a tree, and there always is, the Godswoods
of
Winterfell.
Course.
And, you know, it's just a note that the last time we saw kind of like the Night King attack a fortification with protected by a Weirwood, there was like some kind of magical barrier around it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read some speculation where people wonder whether you're going to find out that Winterfell has some sort of like, you know, that Godswood has some kind of similar protection to it. I mean, I think it's more of like the power of the three-eyed crow, three-eyed raven, and all of the other green seers in that one ancient sacred cave. But that's mm-hmm. that's a possibility. And I also I saw an interview on The Ringer. Ben B sent me this link, which I'll put in the show notes, where they interviewed the people and they said that this was kind of the map that they wanted to do in season one. We had like they always wanted to have the tiles like flipping over to show advancing armies and like territories controlling and castles, but they just never had the time and budget.
Uh-huh.
So like when they were ordered to redo this, it's like fuck yeah, all the tricks that we wanted to do. And also they're like, you know, you had so many. They always wanted to make the castles more clockwork and intricate, but because they had to go to so many different locations to integrate people in the plot, you never had time. Now that everything's kind of just shrinking down, they had the time to like go through the crypts of Winterfell and go through the dungeons
okay.
of King's Landing.
I don't think they should sell themselves too short though, because the old intro was pretty rad too.
It won a few awards.
Yeah,
it's probably I can't think of a 2-minute long intro that's not been fast forwarded through more than this one. So.
Right, and you don't want to fast forward through this next part because
right.
we get back to that ring on the astrolabe and we see an image of the Night King on the right, holding up a wolf's head. Lions on the left, and in the center we see what looks like a wolf's body in like a Stark type cape, riddled with arrows and swords, and hanging.
I would suggest that the what you're calling the Night King is actually a flayed man, which is the sigil for House Bolton.
I think so.
Yeah. So you've got the Lannisters, the Boltons, and then the Freys representing the Twin Towers and the bridge. I think that's just a suggest. I mean, it's a red wedding metaphor, is what I think it is.
Really? Yeah. Seems a little late to be doing a red wedding thing. But
honestly, okay. let's stick with the astrolabe because as cool as I think this is, it's a little head scratchy for me.
Yeah. Okay. I was under the impression that was the Night King, but I thought it was more of a metaphor than like a literal like, oh, Jon's going to be beheaded, but Jon's not even Stark anymore. So
right.
Who knows? Bran's going to be beheaded. Sansa's going to be beheaded.
He's not a Stark. His mama's a Stark.
Yeah, that's true. He's a half Stark.
But the last one is it's got the big dragon with the three small dragons and the bleeding red star, which is clearly like representation of season one going into season two, Dany's dragons being born. Mm-hmm. So the old astrolabe showed the fall of a house, the rise and fall of House Targaryen in historical order.
Okay.
This seems to be showing historical events from the show's own canon, but in like reverse historical order.
Yeah, that's weird.
And do you have any clue why they would do it that way?
No, but I bet any weird time fuckery is going to be tied to Bran.
See, I was wondering if this is very tinfoily, but like, is it possible that they are trying to suggest that there is going to be some kind of Doctor Who timey-wimey bullshit afoot?
I don't know.
And I'm saying bullshit because that's the thing. It's like, there's crazy theories out there about like maybe Bran is actually the Night King, went back in time and blah blah, and like that sounds stupid, but you can make anything cool. Like the basic plot of Terminator sounds really stupid. You got to encase a robot in meat so you can send it back in time to kill the human resistance. It's like what? But it's a cool movie, and I think they could make about anything cool. It's just I don't know. But again, we're speculating on time travel based on the fact that they played these events backwards in the thing, so
right. Who knows? And then also King's Landing is shown. We get a couple of views. We get the Red Keep with the full map courtyard, which I thought was awesome.
Yeah,
callback to last season.
Also, did you notice that there's? I don't know if this is foreshadowing or what, but in the basement of King's Landing, there is one of those ballistas cocked and loaded and pointed right towards a dragon skull.
Presumably, Drogon being the biggest. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was. I mean, that stuff is things that I would all believe to be in the dungeon. Like we know that there's the old Targaryen skulls down there, and there's probably. Even though Qyburn just invented them last season, maybe they got some old relic ballistas down there. But I thought it was the way it's lined up, like you're looking down the gun barrel, was suggestive.
And then, of course, there's the throne room with the Lannister House sigil above the throne, which is the current state of that throne room. Who knows if it'll remain that?
It seems likely that that either the banner, there's going to be banners rising and falling towards the end of the season as a finale, or potentially the throne transform is what I'm hoping for.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
In what way?
Like I said, I see a future
turn to ice.
No, like because the Iron Throne was a symbol of Aegon's conquest and power. So like I feel like even if Dany's going to keep a strict monarchy or Jon, that you would want some other symbol that would presumably transform. That would show the transformation of Westeros and the peoples in it, and how everyone came together. I don't know. Like sitting on a bunch of melted swords is a little bit too bellicose of an ending, I think, for the Dream of Spring.
Sure. I'm with you.
Before we talk more about the episode, I want to tell everybody about an opportunity to lock in savings here at Bald Move. We're having a membership sale at our club, club.baldmove.com. Currently, all of our yearly memberships are sale for 25% off. And this is the first time we've actually included our existing club members. It used to be new members only because we didn't have the technology to give the discount to existing memberships. But now, whether you're an existing club member or you are a person who has never been a club member, you can sign up for a year and save 25% off. And club members can also extend that for up to 5 years.
Yeah.
So if you want to lock in 25% off savings, you can pay for as many years as you want. Again, up to five. If you don't know what our club is a way to get ad-free feeds. It's a way to get special features such as our instant talk version of our podcast, which every Sunday after Game of Thrones, we do our little traditional 15 to 20 minute instant take. But then for club members, we have the instant talk where you can tune in live to our show and get your questions asked and heard by going to baldmove.com. So once again, just go to club.baldmove.com. You can select either a new membership or an existing. These are 25% off our annual memberships, and you can lock in that savings by checking out with the code GOT2019 to enjoy all of your club benefits starting as soon as you sign up. club.baldmove.com. Now we got the excitement of the club sale out of the way. I want to talk about what's going on here at baldmove.com, because another thing that we're doing that's fun for Game of Thrones is another one of our super serious film festivals where we have a themed collection of movie reviews. This year, it's going to be on the subject of fantasy. And we have curated a list of crowd pleasers, or we hope to be crowd pleasers, old swords and sandals and fantasy films. The first one we're going to drop reviews on tomorrow, Wednesday, it's going to be Conan the Barbarian. We had a lot of fun watching it. Club members get to see our live watch, where we actually watch it live and we make jokes and talk about our personal experience with the film. And then everyone can enjoy our full featured review. We love Arnold. We love fantasy. Well, at least half of us unabashedly love fantasy.
Jim, I love that kind of fantasy.
Jim does, and he has a deep and abiding love for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are feeling what we're laying down, check out tomorrow, Super Serious Film Fest, Conan. I keep wanting to say Conan O'Brien.
No, just Conan.
I would love Conan. To see a Conan the Barbarian remake with Conan O'Brien.
Oh, God.
It's a very...
He'd have to put on some serious muscle.
It's just a very...
His
well,
whole frame would have to change.
It's just Weird Al Yankovic UHF. In fact, fuck that. Just go yeah, watch Weird Al Yankovic fair. UHF. But yeah, that's happening this week. Also, don't forget, I wrote two books about Game of Thrones and analyzing its religions and cultures. I was... my co-writer was a expert on comparative religion. It's entertaining. It's informative. I think it's funny. You can get it at godsofthrones.com. You can order it in paperback or ebook format off Amazon, as well as get some cool godsofthrones.com merch. We also have a exclusive enamel pin of our house.
We did have an exclusive enamel pin, but we sold them all.
We sold through the whole run?
Yeah, we sold them all in that first podcast. We didn't buy enough, apparently. So what's happening now is if you go to pin-y.com, you can get pre-orders for the next round, which is already on order.
Uh-huh.
That should hit sometime around the end of the season, we're thinking. So yeah, that's going to be like double the size of the first run, which uh-huh, still will probably sell through. So if you want those, go to pin-y.com right now and get those. It's just a House Snow. If you're familiar with that shirt that we did, which we still have for sale on merch.baldmove.com, by the way.
Yeah.
It's that design on an enamel pin. It looks really nice. Get my girlfriend made it.
Get the pin and the t-shirt and your snow on snow on snow.
There you go.
Strong support for the King of the North. And then finally, Cecil and I will be playing some kind of Super Mario game on twitch.tv/baldmove. It's just our weekly struggle session. Stop on by, say hi, enjoy some beers, some wine, some camaraderie at twitch.tv/baldmove. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Torunaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, now let's get into the episode proper.
Okay.
We get a boy climbing a tree outside Winterfell to watch the arrival of Jon and Dany and their army. Dany gets a bit of a cold reception, but feels pretty good about herself when her dragons fly over and scare the crap out of the townspeople. Afterward, Dany's introduced to Sansa. Bran tells them they have no time to waste because the Night King has the dragon and he's breached the wall. A lot of stuff happens here. And this is, you know, clearly with this kid running through and climbing the tree, a callback to season one.
Oh, yeah.
And there are a lot of them in this episode.
Indeed.
This being the first, because it's the first scene.
I mean, this is just, it starts with the kids, but it's like, you know, a king and a queen coming to Winterfell with their retinue, just like, you know, Robert and Cersei. There's the obvious similarity of Arya pretending to be a soldier, dressed up like a pretend soldier.
And skulking around out.
And now she actually is a soldier. So that's all pretty cool. I also thought that, like, when Tyrion, when they keep on talking about how they've come back with the world's largest army and two full-grown dragons. But the first, you know, knowing that Jon is a Targaryen, that also applies to Jon and Dany, too.
Uh-huh.
So, like, you know, it's not just a mother of dragons. You also have the weird incestual nephew of dragons.
All right.
But I thought that's got to be intentional wordplay. That everyone says that we got two mature, full-grown dragons who probably have tried to have sex with each other. But I like that. And I also like to see the different emotions that wash over Arya's face, like her obvious happiness of seeing Jon and the kind of really frowny face she's got for Sandor. And then Gendry gets like a shy kind of smile. Unfortunate that the first words of this season were yet another dumb eunuch joke from Tyrion.
Yeah. I have not been a fan of those jokes for a very long time, since I think season 5.
Yeah.
Once they, like, got to Essos.
Yeah.
And kept the ribbing up, I was like, come on, man.
Well, this isn't like two friends can't joke about each other's shortcomings. It's
sure.
more of like, this show's associated cheap eunuch jokes with lesser men, like Littlefinger. And like Sansa, I used to think Tyrion one of the cleverest men alive. And like even the show's like, come on.
Yeah, I can't tell if they're intentionally like saying, okay, we went maybe a little overboard with this stuff in the other season. But then there are other ways to point that out without actually doing it again.
It could be I wanted those elephants, like a fan. But we'll see if there's more. Ballless jokes to come.
God, I hope not. My prediction is this is the last episode with jokes in it.
Okay.
Because shit's going to get real here very soon. Of course it won't be, but I want to talk a little bit more about Arya, because this has got to be surreal for her, right? When you think of this world and how big it is and how often people die or just never return to the places they were.
Yeah.
having kind of all of Arya's friends and family come home at the same time is just like this really strange thing. Or at least it would be for me if I were standing there going down the line saying, oh, there's my brother. I'm looking forward to this. Oh, there's Sandor. I thought he was dead. Oh, shit. Right. There's Gendry. I never thought I'd see him again.
Right. But plus, this goes, this is on the back of her dad trying to smuggle her out with the Night's Watch and get her back to home, her almost getting to River Run just in time for the Red Wedding, her going to the gates of her aunts and
these close misses,
and finding out she's dead and the hysterical laughter. It's like every single time she has thought that she has been here before, it's been like Charlie Brown in the football yanked away from her. Right. So like that all these years of history build up to make these, and they didn't have to like. I mean, they didn't really have to gild the lily on these scenes. Like, they just let the director even mentioned David Nutter that, like, they just let Kit and Maisie kind of react, and that's all you needed. Not much in the way of direction and dialogue, just these two people who had not worked with each other for like 6-7 seasons. Mm-hmm. Put them on screen and film them.
And I appreciated the fanfare here, too. I thought it was an appropriate amount. You know, this is a big event. All the forces are arraying here in Winterfell. And we as an audience want to feel that. You know, we're back for the first time in a year and a half.
Yeah.
The show's been off the air for a long time. It's the final season.
Yeah.
And I felt it, you know. I was engrossed by this scene.
I also was scoring a little bit more closely on subsequent watches about, who is more incivil to whom in these things. Because, like, it's, there's hostility on all sides, and Jon's trying to be the peacemaker. But I will note that Danny tried to come at Sansa civil, like, hey, the North is as beautiful as and as are you, like, very complimentary. And Sansa started the frost off, I think.
This is after Danny smirked as her dragon scared the shit out of the Winterfellians.
That's yes. I don't think that's a good look for Danny, but I also don't think Sansa saw it. And Sansa seemed kind of like, that's the thing is like, see, I think not so secretly, Sansa's happy the dragons are here because that was her reaction. She sees it in her smile, like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you'd rather have, it's like stealth bombers showing up. I'd rather have them than not. So, but I feel like Sansa's playing politics because she's right. Or Jon's right. She is angling to make sure her family is safe after all this is said and done. Mm-hmm. Seems kind of crazy to me, but this shit is really important to these people. And it's really important for Sansa to never put herself under some other person's power that she doesn't 100% trust ever again.
Yeah, I think everybody's angle here is really good. You know, I mean, whether or not Danny's going to be another Mad King is a question that's still up in the air. And so for us, even as an audience, to be asking the same questions as Sansa is, as, you know, Sam is, that's important. And I enjoy it.
So then, as you say, Bran kind of focuses everybody up and says, we, you know, because they start, there's this kind of smug off, and Bran kind of comes up there. So we don't have time for any of this. The Night King has your dragon. The walls fall and the dead march south. And I think this is interesting in light of Bran then later choosing to set off a succession war between Jon and Dany. Like, we don't have time for this, but why would he say to Sam that Jon needs to know right now? Like,
yeah, it must be important to the end game somehow.
Yeah, and how could that be?
Because a lot of people have speculated about whether or not Bran can see the future. Mm-hmm. And I think at the very least, he can see the near future because he's waiting for Jaime, where he knows Jaime will be showing up.
Right. Which is another odd thing. If we don't have time for anything, we have this omniscient being who sits in a courtyard waiting for Jaime. There's a couple loose connections on the circuit board here, is all I'm saying.
Sure. I think Bran can only do so much. You know, his power is more about seeing, not doing. And so he can kind of see what's going to happen. And in a lot of instances, like, he's just got to wait for Jaime to get there.
I will say this, that maybe I think everyone's skeptical kind of now of Bran, but I really hope that Bran has a way to, like, demonstrate his utmost reliability to people like Tyrion. Because otherwise, if Tyrion never, like, has a long conversation with Bran, it's going to feel very weird. Because I feel like that's, like, Tyrion craves information. He's an analytical thinker. Bran has nothing but information. He's like, a Google search. Mm-hmm. Those two people should get together and strategize and plan, and it would be odd if they don't. So I'm counting down the episodes until they have a powwow, because if they don't, unless Tyrion's dead or I guess Bran dies.
Yeah. On the other hand, what I really don't want to see from Bran is him going around proving his powers to everyone.
Yeah.
Like one at a time.
Yeah.
I don't need the sit down where, you know, Tyrion says, "Oh, how do I know that what you're saying is true?" And he proves that, and then he could go to Dany. "How do I know what you're saying is true?"
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't think they're going to do that because they don't have time and they know it.
The other question I have before is, I felt like the moment, and I felt like this last season too, when Dany's reaction to the death of one of her children was fairly muted. Mm-hmm. There is no reaction at all to Bran dropping the knowledge that not only is the dragon dead, it's been turned into a zombie dragon. Like, that moment did not get, did not allow, like, I don't know what I was expecting, but I guess I felt like that moment should have breathed a little bit more.
Yeah, I think this moment is weird for Dany, because there's this kid who she doesn't know at all telling her a thing about her dragon that she may or may not believe. Like, why is she going to believe what Bran says? He's telling her a terrible thing,
right?
That she's both horrified at the sound of, but also unsure whether or not to believe, I think, in that moment.
Right. But I feel like that should be spoken. Like, who
I thought
is
it
this
was on her face, but it was
person?
A very short.
Why?
Moment.
Why? What is he? How do you know this? You know, or John, you know, everyone acted like this was just kind of like neutral information or old news or something like that. And I thought it was a weird choice.
I'll give you that. It doesn't quite play, I think, how I would want it to, but
yeah, especially then because
it's close.
It seems like there's a lot of statements here, like focus everyone's resolve towards the actual task at hand. Yeah. And then the next scene immediately bleeds that tension off. Cause we go from here, this kind of apocalyptic scenario outlined by Bran, right into bitching about how we're going to feed this world's largest army.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Sansa sends Lord Umber back to Last Hearth with a bunch of wagons to fetch his people. Lady Mormont questions Jon's decision to relinquish his kingship to Dany. And Jon's defense is that he brought a powerful ally to protect the North. And then Sansa worries about how they're going to feed the new troops. And Dany, very smug in this scene. Like, I get that, you know, she's being essentially shit on here. Like, saying, look, we don't want you as our queen.
Yep.
In no such terms. But very obviously, that's the feeling. But man, she comes across as really fucking smug with that final line.
Yeah.
And this is good to me, because I think what they're really trying to do here is put that question to the test. Does she deserve to be the queen? Is she going to go the Mad King route? And how do people feel about her being the queen, and what's going to change their mind?
Right.
Because right now there's not a lot to change their mind.
Yeah.
Other than the danger that's approaching, and these people haven't really seen it yet. You know, John certainly has seen it, but he's kind of the only one other than Dany.
I thought it was interesting because in the off season I read George Martin's Targaryen biography or history book, Fire and Blood, and it seemed like it was a recurring theme that the Targaryens had difficulties with the northern lords and ladies, that they tend to be pig-headed and
stubborn as goats.
Stubborn as goats, exactly. And it seems like the Targaryens that were willing to put up with that and swallow the shit and even though it made them angry and drove them crazy, you know, would eventually earn the Northerners' respects, the ones that kind of like all fire and blood, or some of the worst Targaryens. So I think this is obviously a kind of a litmus test. Like, just as it was important for Jon to be able to stitch the wildlings and the North together, it's going to be that important for Dany to, through some kind of action, probably some kind of heroic sacrifice or show of leadership or something, weld all of these disparate armies together. And so that they're going to be jointly following her. It's going to be tricky with Jon's claim to the throne to navigate as well.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that when we get to that scene. But
I thought everyone defended themselves pretty well.
Oh yeah, Jon's statements make a lot of sense here.
Yeah,
and it's what he's been saying all along. You know, he's never changed his tune.
Right.
So then we go over to Gendry unloading the dragonglass, Tyrion reuniting with Sansa, and he's showing his respect for her. However, Sansa's respect is a little diminished for him by his belief that Cersei is going to honor her word. She used to think him one of the most clever men she's ever met.
We talked a little bit about this in the different preview podcasts, but what's your thought on the idea that Cersei and Tyrion have some kind of secret understanding. It's not necessarily an outright betrayal of Dany, but like we didn't get to hear the full. I mean, I think it's obvious we didn't get to hear the full story because they've
They cut away,
cut away in mid conversation.
Right?
But do you think that there is a possibility because he does look kind of guilty and hangdog, but there's a lot of reasons for him to have that demeanor talking to this particular woman.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons for him to have that look. Not talking to this woman. You add Sansa into the mix, and yeah, right. There are tons of reasons. But, I mean, he could just be feeling like, oh, shit, yeah, you're right. Maybe I shouldn't be so quick to trust my sister.
I mean, honestly, as he was saying it, like, look, I think the deal is Cersei's got a reason to live and a reason that she wants to survive. And Sansa's like, well, then she's going to pull all of her armies around, like a ring around her and fuck everyone else.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing that... You know, Tyrion's, it's been a long time since we've seen season 3 Tyrion.
Oh, yeah.
I think we need to see a return to that kind of Tyrion.
I don't know that we're going to.
Man, I hope so. I hope he has I hope he's got a good moment of leadership or intellect or cunning or something. Because if not, why is he alive?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only opportunity he's really got from here to probably the end of the series is... King's Landing, like when they go to battle Cersei once and for all, which I hope is going to happen.
He's got to have,
he needs to have something up his sleeve. Otherwise, yeah, Tyrion's kind of just a flat nothing at the end.
Yeah, that would be the sweetest if like all these things came together with a way for him to outmaneuver politically and militarily his sister, and he's the only one with that unique insight. Or even and Jaime and Tyrion together.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, maybe now there's an opportunity with Jaime coming up.
Right. Right. She's ticklish behind her left knee.
But he's going to have to look like a fool before that, because Jaime's going to come up and say, no, Tyrion, you idiot.
Yeah.
She's actually planning behind your back to totally screw you over.
Yeah.
Just as our sister, who you know as well as I do almost.
Yeah.
Not physically, maybe, but you know.
Right.
You know.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
should know this, man. Tyrion. What are you doing?
Two other things I want to point out. Number one, this may be the line of the night when Tyrion said the Purple Wedding was a miserable affair, and Sansa said it had its moments.
And yeah, but then she also realizes, oh, shit, yeah, no. One of those moments was me bouncing and leaving you in the lurch.
I don't think she's apologetic because, like, she said, hey, we both survived. And also...
Well, that's excuse is such bullshit.
I think, like, Sansa would trade place with Tyrion in a fucking heartbeat.
Oh, probably. But let's talk about that idea of, oh, we both survived.
Uh-huh.
That's such a cop-out bullshit argument.
You think Sansa owed it to Tyrion?
No. What I'm saying is, like, the result does not alleviate any responsibility for decisions you made in the moment.
That's true.
That could have led to the death of someone. Oh, well, it turned out fine.
I'm
like, oh, I threw you off this bridge into a...
If I'm Sansa, I take any offer to get the fuck out of there, no matter who...
I agree, 100%.
Yeah.
But
if the people that get hurt,
but
last
so many
name Lannister,
people,
fuck it.
So many people use this excuse. Like, oh, you're still alive, right?
Yeah.
No problem then. We're all good.
Right.
No, you fucker. You made a bad choice and
it
hurt me.
I feel like that's like... bullshit when a parent says it to a kid about endangering them, because there's a fiduciary responsibility to like take care of that person and protect them and like be like, hey, my shitty parenting made you strong. That's but like Sansa, she's like 15 and fuck that. I
she made the choice she had to make, but it affected Tyrion.
Yes,
certainly.
That is certainly a true point. The other thing I want to say is, did you notice the crows in the background? And then there's the smash cut to creepy Bran staring. I think you're supposed to understand that, like, Bran's going to know literally everything.
Gotcha.
Because that was a motif in the first seasons, like, the crows kind of conspicuously here and there around Bran. Now they're like, you know, it's Game of Thrones, they're everywhere. And that's just a reminder of, like, Bran's new power. And I'm sure that will come in. That's going to blow something wide open before the season's over.
That might imply that he can't actually see the future, and what he saw was through a crow's eye. He kind of saw everything happening in King's Landing as it was happening, and he knew Jaime was on the way.
Same thing about the Night's King. Like, did he? I don't think he predicted that he was massing there. I think that's something he actually saw.
Yeah,
like, that's that future foretelling is, I think, a little bit still speculative, and also like, you know, is the future set in stone? Is it no fate but what we make, like Sarah Connor would say? Or
good question. All right, we go to John reflecting at the Weirwood when Arya shows up for a joyous Big Brother Little Sister reunion. and they admire each other's swords. And then Arya reminds Jon that they're all a family, and that's important, and he shouldn't forget it when it comes to Sansa.
I think this is the showrunner setting up the challenge to Jon's character that he has, I think, well-founded faith in Dany, even though she does go crazy from time to time. I think that the real challenge is going to be keeping true to that faith without losing the support of his family. Because he needs that too.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the thing. Like, you know, I'm family. Don't forget that. That's going to be your challenge, John. And not only did not forget it, because he's about to literally transform from Stark or Snow Stark to a Targaryen. So I think this is going to be even more meaningful now that he realizes that he's not even, you know, like the fact that they're not even brothers and sisters at this point. They're cousins or whatnot.
No, but it definitely ties back into like the Theon thing, right?
Yes.
Where Theon saves Yara and then he says, well, he doesn't say it, but you can tell on his face he wants to go back and fight with the Starks.
Well, that ties back into Jon kind of forgiving him from last season.
Exactly.
Like, you know, you can be whoever you want to be, like we talked last
season. But he grew up as sort of a Stark, just the way Jon did.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's kind of what I took away from it at the end. It's like very much remember when you become Aegon Targaryen.
But all this dialogue is going to set up this kind of fulcrum it's going to be a battle between his loyalties and his family and all that. Now,
and his friends.
I think the challenge for the showrunners for me is to I actually don't think they're going to go down to where Jon breaks faith with Dany. It's going to be more of like, how can he keep faith without looking like just a complete idiot or lapdog? But like, they do go down the road of Jon having a serious like, oh no, maybe I'm king, I should be king. Like, Jon's had bigger tests of loyalty. Like, he's chosen his duty and his duty and his people over his love, over his position in the Night's Watch, over his own honor. Like, he's made way more sacrifices, and like, you know, it's not even the first time he's been in love and made that sacrifice. So the challenge is for them to answer is like, why is it different this time? I guess.
Yeah.
But I'm actually hoping that the conflict is going to be an inner one between John's loyalty to his family and Dany, and not like his personal ambition and Dany.
Yeah, I don't think so. John doesn't strike me as that guy. I'm curious how these ingredients are going to mix him and Dany, though. Cause...
I mean, if the Iron Throne is like the one ring and it literally drove people psychically crazy, then sure, but they don't have that mechanism, so...
All right, speaking of crazy, we go to Qyburn, who tells Cersei that the dead have broken through the wall, to which Cersei responds, good. She's looking forward to this. And then we see the forces of Euron, the ships, the Iron Fleet. Is that what they call it?
Yep.
And we go out to Euron's flagship, and we find Yara still alive. And Euron tells her he's going to go fuck the queen. And he appreciates the conversation she has not been supplying him with. Because he's got a crew full of mutes. Did we know that as show watchers?
I don't think so.
Okay, I thought that was a book-only thing so far.
Yeah.
But I do these spoiler casts, so I don't know anymore.
Right, yeah. No, the lore behind that is that Euron rips the tongues out of everyone that serves him on his crew for... I don't know. Book Euron is like this horrifying pirate warlock guy that's dabbling in black magic and all this other shit. This version is such a bizarre... decoloring of that character. I'm not a big Greyjoy fan, obviously. I haven't hid that bias, but like, if you are a Greyjoy fan, it must be really annoying to have this version of Euron come to the screen. Like,
as someone who doesn't read the books, I kind of like this version of Euron. He's the physical embodiment of arrogance, and it's not a subtle character,
right?
But it is one that mixes interestingly with other ingredients in the show.
Yeah, he's like in the show, he's just an experienced junkie. Like, you know, he's wanting to fight and he's wanting to fuck.
I mean, he's going to do the craziest shit until he dies.
Right.
And then, you know, that's his plan.
Right.
And I guess I'm okay with that. Now, they haven't used him super effectively, I don't think. There haven't been those interesting interactions other than like with Jaime. But even that was cut short. So I don't know. I don't mind Euron. So anything on Yara being alive? Yara's alive.
Yara's alive, and I my only question is, I wonder if we'll ever see her again after the scene that we see her again next time.
I don't know. The scene where they part definitely feels like a final meeting of Theon and Yara, to me, anyway. So we may not see her again. Anyway, Cersei takes an audience with Euron and the leader of the Golden Company, Captain Harry Strickland, apparently, which is maybe the worst possible name to throw into this show at this point.
Yeah.
Worse than Dickon? Strickland's just so fucking... It sounds like he's out of a detective novel. This is a terrible name for this universe.
It's like having somebody named Tom Smith in Star Wars.
Yeah. It makes no sense
to me. Smith. Captain Harry Strickland of the Golden Company. What? Are you sure he's not in an accounting firm? Community?
Yeah, if he was with the Iron Bank, maybe.
Right. It's interesting because he shares this name of the commander in the books, because there is an actual commander of the Golden Company.
Yeah.
But he is nothing like his book depiction. He's old and portly and balding, and this guy is he looks like Jaime Lannister's season one stunt double.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you could totally, like Harrison Ford, you know, when he poses with his stunt double, and it's like, oh, it's Harrison Ford, until you get to the face, like, oh, that's not Harrison Ford. Yeah. That's what the guy looks like.
I agree.
And he doesn't have elephants.
He doesn't, which is super disappointing both to Cersei and, I think, us as an audience.
We have 17 waterfalls in the north, but no elephants, no direwolves.
As a show-only watcher,
uh-huh.
What sense does this scene make with the elephants?
I think this is literally just a wink to book readers. And, like, the show, and maybe the show watchers know that. So it's kind of like, oh, I'm missing out on the books, or I don't know.
I mean, I know that because we do this podcast, but I wouldn't know that if we didn't. And I think it would be weird to be like, elephant, why is she so concerned about elephants?
Yeah.
But
I don't know. Do you think
it's still fine to do fan service every once in a while?
Yeah, it is odd, though. There's been a couple, I think they've done that before, but I felt like it's not been as fourth wall breaking.
Right.
You know, where they'll mention something that's just like a detail that's just in passing, that like a book reader would be like, oh, I rustle my jimmies. But for show, it's the difference between name checking a location that a book reader would be familiar with, whereas that's just world building to a show watcher. I don't know what's the significance of, like, oh, I'm going to Hardhome. I don't know where wait till I get there. Book reader's like, oh, I know what's Hardhome.
Right.
It's weird because this is like making a drawing a big circle and putting a big flashing light on it. Like, if you're, like you said, if you're a show watcher, you feel left out, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, because we knew nothing of these elephants.
Not the greatest wink to the book readers.
So Euron basically invites himself into Cersei's bed, which actually manages to just barely... He barely arrogance his way in, which I guess is the key to Cersei's heart. Just be as arrogant as humanly possible.
It's a little beggy and whiny.
which makes me think Cersei has a bigger plan in mind, which we'll talk about here in a couple scenes.
Right.
Before that, we got to go to Bronn, who's in the middle of a four-way when Qyburn interrupts to say there's a wagon outside with four chests of gold and his name on it if he's willing to take Joffrey's crossbow and go kill Cersei's brothers. Bronn doesn't say no, and Qyburn leaves him with the weapon.
This is actually, I love this scene because it's such great Bronn.
Oh, yeah, classic Bronn.
And I don't think we've ever seen Bronn completely bereft of, like, a Tyrion or a Jaime. So he's just playing with this weird old straight man wizard.
Yeah.
And the whole, you know, the Qyburn's, oh, poor girl, the pox will take her within a year. And he's like, which girl? So funny. And then when he pulls out the crossbow, Joffrey's crossbow, and he's like, oh, that fucking family. It's so great.
It is.
It's so great. It's all seven seasons of him dealing with every one of these fucking people and getting fucked over by them and having to protect them and bail their asses out. And it's pretty good. It's pretty good. But also kind of seems silly for Cersei to give him a wagon full of gold. Paying it in advance is not the world's greatest... For a service of a sellsword, especially one like Bronn, not the greatest use of one's money, wouldn't seem.
Yeah, and one who's losing faith. I mean, he essentially sells Qyburn, and he's on the wrong side at this point.
Yeah.
And yet he's being hired to go kill. There's no way. There's no way that Bronn takes his crossbow and goes and even tries to murder both of them.
Nah.
He goes up there probably and he meets with them, but it's not to kill them.
Right. Wouldn't think.
Wouldn't think so either. There's another small detail in the scene that I thought was a nice little callback, because I remember in season 7, in the opener, everybody hated Ed Sheeran. They hated him, his character. So in the beginning of the scene, these prostitutes are talking, and they say that this character named Eddie had his whole face burned off, and he has no eyelids now, and that's the character that Ed Sheeran played.
The ginger? Yeah.
So if you hated Ed Sheeran, just know he got his justice.
Yeah, he got Quentin'd.
So after they have sex, Euron tries to figure out how he stacks up to Cersei's other lovers. Cersei's attracted to his arrogance. Before he leaves, he tells her he's going to put a prince in her belly, which puts some kind of expression on her face. How are you reading this scene?
So this seems like she is gearing up to do the same scam on Euron that she did on Robert all these many years, that Jaime would get her with child, as they would say, mm-hmm. and then she would seduce Robert, and then no one would be the wiser. So
yeah.
I think what we're seeing now that I know the context of this is kind of like this laugh at like a yet another foolish man that I'm taking advantage of and literally cucking them. like this is, you know, like the cuckoo. She's like laying an egg in another man's nest and he's going to take care of it. But then like also realizing that this is probably like, unlike the other time where this is just a joke that her and Jamie are pulling over on Robert, like, this is all her alone, and she might never see Jamie again. That's where the laugh turns into like a sob.
Mm-hmm.
I think it all checks out.
Yeah, I agree. After watching it a couple more times, I think that's right on. And it's nice too, because she can not only pull this over on Euron, but you know, if she's victorious in this battle, she now has another, you know, some witnesses to say, hey, her and Euron got down. So the people might not think, oh, well, it's another incest baby.
She's trying to keep the... you know, it's funny that you'd think that, like, the incest baby, the least of her propaganda problems now, but...
Yeah.
But what are you going to do? I also think it's ironic that Euron, by taunting her memory of the Fat King, is kind of like... He doesn't get the fact that, like, oh, that's what she did with him. Is that what... Or maybe he does and he just doesn't care. But I feel like that's also underlining kind of the point that they're making in this scene.
So then we go to Theon saving Yara successfully. He kind of sneaks in because Euron's got a crew full of mutes who can't alert anybody when their throat is slit open. And she punches him to the ground for not having saved her before when he could have, and helps him back up. And Yara says they should take the Iron Islands back in case the living need somewhere to retreat to. Then Yara sees that Theon really wants to fight for the Starks in Winterfell, so she tells him to go. Which I definitely think this is a parting of ways permanently.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like she'd come back from this. Maybe she'll be like in a finale in some kind of throne room celebration type of scene.
Well, I really think like the thing that nobody is thinking about here is that the White Walkers don't have to cross water. Mm-hmm. They've got a fucking dragon.
It's true.
You just fly out to the Iron Island and blast.
Right.
They don't know it, so they can't be blamed for not thinking about it. But the Iron Islands aren't safe.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because there's... I was going to talk about... I wrote these books in the off-season about the religions and cultures of Westeros. And in my research, I found in the World of Ice and Fire, there's this maester who makes this observation that weirwoods never grew on the Iron Islands. Because they need a certain quality of soil, and it was too poor for them to take purchase, and consequently there's no evidence that the Children of the Forest ever journeying to the Iron Islands too. There's like evidence of this weird kind of ancient precursor civilization that I talk a little bit about in the books, but I was thinking that this is interesting because Yara actually probably has a right of it. Without the dragon, I wonder if since we know that these things are essentially some kind of runaway weapon from the Children of the Forest, it's entirely possible that the White Walkers couldn't get over to the Iron Islands because it makes sense that the same magic that kind of created them would bind them to kind of more of Westeros. Now, there's always been a question of, like, what if you'd never defeated the Night King or the White Walkers and they were able to take over all of Westeros and the entire globe freezes and then is this just a Westeros problem or Essos problem?
Right.
I don't know that you can definitively say either way, except for there are a lot of, like, Azor Ahai type prophecies from Essos, which implies that it can get a big problem on a really long night, but mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of an interesting point. And if you want to read more, I got a whole chapter of Greyjoy shit and got godsofthrones.com. Did you see the cameo by Mac from Always Sunny?
No.
The guy that got his eye shot out by the arrow, Rob McElhenney?
Rob McElhenney, yeah.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. I'll have to go back and look at that.
Yeah.
I missed it.
Yeah. He was, they had an interview with him on some of the extra features and he was, cause they've had the Double D's wrote an episode of Always Sunny. I think they've written two now.
Yes.
So it's kind of cool to see the cultural, exchange happening back and forth.
Right. Okay. Then we move to, the Karstarks arriving in Winterfell as Davos tries to impress upon Tyrion just how much of a role loyalty and oaths play in the lives of Northerners. He follows that up with the suggestion that they propose a proposal. I'm going to suggest a suggestion that John and Dany become a couple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk about John and Dany here in a second. But I just don't think Tyrion quite understands the Northerners yet. And Davos definitely does at this point.
Well, it's weird that there's I'm skeptical the young will listen to the old. But they're not suggesting anything that these two, I don't think, would be amenable to. Unless some kind of rift between them, which, again, depending on how John handles this.
It's almost like they're two steps behind plotting a coupling that has already happened and they should not be so oblivious to. But Tyrion knows, right? Tyrion heard them banging on the boat. He knows what's up.
Yeah.
He doesn't let on, really, in the scene.
Was an odd way for him to play it. I'm not sure why it went that way. But I don't know. Maybe there's because the previous scene where the Theon rescued Yara, that did feel very kind of rushed and perfunctory because, Theon just easily took over the Silence, the flag, and I feel like if they had established a mute thing and that had been Theon exploiting Euron's cruelty against him, it would have felt like an earned moment as it is. It felt he hit the easy button and won.
He sort of got lucky. Euron was out,
And then this scene here with the I felt like there's a couple things that I liked everything in isolation, but in context of what everyone should know and be thinking about, it was a little weird.
How pissed do you think Euron's going to be? He finds out that while he was off fucking the queen, Theon swept in.
Pretty pissed, I would say.
Yeah.
Pretty pissed.
You think he's going to take some rash actions to try and rectify the situation?
Do you know how long it takes to train a crew of mutes to run a complicated sailboat? Uh-huh. Do you know how much yelling and screaming usually happens on a sailing ship of that size just to weigh anchor and leave port?
Now he's got to start off
from scratch. Euron's just off the game board now. He can't even pilot his own fucking ship.
That's true. He's like a one-man crew in Sea of Thieves.
Imagine Han Solo and Chewbacca trying to get out of Hoth, except for not only does Han not speak Wookiees, but Chewbacca is also a mute.
Yeah.
This line goes there, and this sail goes, and also there's 500 of them, and they all have to work together. So, I think Euron's is done.
You would think that on a boat with a purely mute crewed boat, you would have some sort of system of bells or cables that you can pull to alert people to certain actions.
Get splitting migraines. So he just, there's no
deal
bells,
with the bells. Yeah.
There's no whistles. There's no tongues.
Seems like an oversight.
If you fart, you're executed.
Oh.
Just to silence. He takes it very serious. His branding, very seriously.
All right. So let's move on to Dany finding out that her dragons aren't eating because they don't like the North. So before we go to the rest of the scene, I just wanted her to finish this fucking sentence because she says they're talking about Sansa and how, she's not totally on board with her yet. And she says, I am her queen. If she can't respect me, .. And she gets interrupted. and I want her to finish that fucking sentence. That's the most important then sentence in this entire episode. Yeah. Exactly.
That'll perk them right up.
Exactly.
Once they've had a northern princess lady, they'll that.
What do they eat?
Going.
Whatever I feed them, Sansa. So watch your mouth. Yeah, that's a very important sentence, and she does not finish it.
I also thought they don't like the North. That felt like a mom out of touch for why her teenagers are moody. Like, she thinks it's because, you know, they got cut from the wrestling team. It's actually because their girlfriend broke up with them, but they don't know anything about it. Isn't the obvious answer that they lost one of their siblings?
That's exactly what I was thinking.
And they're mourning, but she's like, oh, it must be that they don't like the North because it's cold.
Yeah. So, I don't know. This whole scene seems a little bit weird. She finds out they're not eating. Then there's big CG bucks being spent by HBO, and we get a fairly impressive dragon joyriding scene.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it's so well done.
Then they pull over long enough to get it on. That is, if John can keep it up with Drogon watching him, staring intently at him.
Is it possible that Bran is warging the Drogon?
It's totally possible.
Because,
yes.
The intensity of the stare is very similar.
Oh, yeah. That's very intentional, similar. Right? To draw some kind of parallel, and I don't know what the purpose is, but
because otherwise it's just, I mean, I think it works on two levels. If they want to suggest that this is actually Bran keeping creepy tabs on his brother,
yeah,
because why wouldn't he? Also because he knows that there's the real truth and it'd be good to keep tabs on this political situation, but also it's just like the dogs having watching have sex, you know.
Uh-huh.
It works as just a visual gag.
For sure.
But like I said in my preamble to this episode, this is a fine scene. I just feel like knowing that John is riding the dragon that's named after his father and Danny's brother, that's like, if this would have been like a moment of realization that, yes, I can do this. I can be a dragon rider because it's in my blood, and versus just like, okay, well, if a dragon likes you for any reason, you can hop on and take him for a ride. I don't know. It felt more like Harry Potter riding a hippogriff. Like, it's just there for...
I was going to say Atreyu riding Falgor, but okay. Yeah.
No, it's just purely aspirational. Like, wouldn't it be cool to ride a dragon with your lady friend? It's Aladdin on the carpet. It's But it could have been more. And I feel like slight reordering of the sequence of events here, it could have been. And But it was really, really sweet. Seemed like it'd be really fucking cold. They're not wearing hoods. They're not wearing masks. They're going.
Yeah,
they're going flight speeds. In very cold air.
Yeah, I bet that free fall was fun though.
Yeah, I think it'd be terrifying. Like, you're in zero G, and the only thing holding you on is gripping this dragon's floppy horns.
Yeah, I don't know how they stay on these things, but we'll overlook that. So
I think John should have flown a little bit further north and taken her to the hot springs. Fuck them waterfalls. Yeah. Hot springs where it's at.
Well, who's to say there's not a hot pool under those falls?
It's true. Also, the hot springs are super empty. Like, you had 100,000 wildlings you had to compete with before. Now it's just hot spring sex, no waiting.
It's true. All right, Gendry is casting dragonglass weapons while the Hound gives him grief until Arya shows up, and they sort of exchange mean mugs until the Hound finally cracks and his respect for her still being alive slips through. Arya then asks Gendry to make her a new weapon as they lightly tease each other.
So, I mean, yeah, Arya Sandor, weird. It was more antagonistic than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
From at least his side of things. Because I thought that him and Brienne kind of shared a moment of being kind of proud of their shared parentage last season. I thought that might shine through a little bit more, but that it's fine. I feel like we talked a lot in the instant cast about Arya and Gendry flirting and how we thought about that. Like, we're kind of neutral to in favor.
Yeah, I think so.
They're cute.
I honestly have a hard time seeing Arya with anyone at the end of this, but you know, if anyone, Gendry, sure. He seems like a cool guy.
The one thing that we were going to catch up on was Arya's mystery weapon.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I've heard some reported as a double-ended spear. The telescoping thing is still in play. I'm not really sure what to make of it or how it would be more effective than the weapons that she already has, because she has a Valyrian steel dagger, which we know will take out White Walkers. I don't know if she knows that.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, Valyrian-tipped spears would be about... Like, spears were kings of the battlefield for a long, 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 long time. Mm. Like, pretty much up until, like, the invention of gunpowder and rifles and whatnot. So, like, having... Because I saw some people suggest it might be, like, a blow dart, kind of like Jack and Hagar would use, which would be kind of cool, like a... Like a obsidian flechet kind of thing that you can
that
shoot,
tip
but
looks
but also
enormous.
Yeah,
heavy.
It does seem like it's some kind of. And we saw in the trailers, of course, Arya is swinging around like some kind of bow staff looking weapon. I think it's that we're just seeing, right. And it's probably got some trick that it can split in half, kind of like Darth Maul's lightsaber, and like Darth Maul himself.
Yeah,
can be split in half and still be combat effective, as we found out in Solo.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's I don't think it's going to be like any kind of magical super weapon beyond just dragonglass tipped spear that can transform into probably two daggers with crazy long handles. Yeah. And you know, that's the other thing. Right. It's like, you know, like I just think it's a reach problem. It's like when you're why would you fight zombies hand to hand with like a dagger? You need a little bit more reach. So that's what it's gonna give her. It's gonna allow her to believably kind of whirl through these crowds and kill a bunch of White Walkers and zombies without putting herself at risk.
Yeah, makes sense. All right, then we go to Sansa delivering Jon the news that the Glovers are not coming to support them at Winterfell. Jon's pissed at Glover, but Sansa's pissed at Jon for abandoning his crown. So Jon makes the case for why his title doesn't matter, and Dany is their only chance to save the North. And Sansa asks him whether he bent the knee to save the North or because he loves Dany. Fair questions all around. Like, I think everybody makes their point here and has valid points, which mm-hmm. is what I appreciate out of a scene. Like, characters acting on the things they believe and butting heads over things that they should rightfully believe.
Yeah, but that, you know, coming out of last season, one of my big questions is how are they going to make a struggle between Dany and Jon, which did seem like they're gearing up for, believable? And I think this is the answer. It's mm-hmm. not going to be really a struggle between Jon and Dany. It's going to be a struggle between Dany winning the allegiance of all of Westeros and Jon not having his family suspect that he's under the spell of some Targaryen. Yeah, there's bad blood on both sides. Like, you know, next week, you know, Jaime meeting Dany is going to be high comedy, I'm sure, as the Kingslayer, as the murderer of his father. But, like, there's a lot of fucked up shit because, you know, her father murdered their grandfather and uncle and started off the whole Robert's Rebellion
thing. Nobody's innocent here.
Yeah. No. There's if people start adding up tallies and bills and trying to sort that out, the Night King just wins. So the tension's mm-hmm. going to be... Again, Jon and Dany trying to convince everyone to be altruistic. And honestly, I think this is a test of Dany's character, too.
Oh, 100%.
Because I think she should at least be willing to consider Jon's claim. Like, Jon might, like, say, well, I think you're still, like, you still are the better queen.
Oh, I think, yeah, if it comes to that, if there's a choice to be made here, I think Jon, like I said in the preview podcast, essentially says, no, I've pledged myself to this queen. Right. Even though I'm rightfully king, I've already made my choice, and I'm going to honor that.
But if Dany comes at it like, well, it's just I have to be queen because why?
Yeah,
point,
no, you don't
know,
want that to
just because I wanted it really bad and I've worked really hard. And I like, okay. So
because dragons?
Yeah, but I do think they're going to set it up between, you know, it's going to be more of it's a war for the people's hearts and minds more than Jon's. And I hope so, because again, I ain't buying Jon having a big crisis of conscience about whether he should be king or not and whether Dany's crazy.
No. I think it definitely complicates things, though, mm-hmm. because, you know, the North wants a leader that they already trust and can follow. And Jon now has the opportunity to say, that's me. Look, I've got the loyalty of the queen here because we've been working together for so long now. I've got your loyalty already because I've already shown you what I can do. Now, as the rightful heir to the throne, maybe they might want him to step up and be king, but I really don't see Jon.
Here's the thing, because I was almost ready to say that it makes more sense for Dany to bend the knee to Jon, because Jon has this truculent people who are deeply suspicious of her, and, you know, Dany has this army who's essentially unwaveringly loyal. But I thought, well, that's treating the Unsullied like they're still slaves, and they're not. Like, I actually think if Dany bends the knee to Jon, that might start a crisis of conscience in them. Because, like, part of their fanatical following of Dany is this kind of almost manifest destiny that she's the mother of dragons and she's Misha and she's all this. And if she kneels to some other foreigner, what the fuck does that? And the Dothraki, what the hell? So, like,
this almost feels like it could be a a contest of like, who doesn't want to be the leader the most, right? Right. Like, John's, no, I've already pledged myself to you. Yeah, Danny's like, no, we need this for the North to follow us. And they go back and forth over, I don't want it. You take it.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't see that happening, but we'll see. So then Jorah takes Danny to meet Sam, the man who cured his grayscale. Unfortunately, when Danny hears his house name, she has to drop the bomb that she murdered not only his father, but his beloved brother as well. And it devastates Sam, who runs out into the night and finds Bran waiting for an old friend, as he says. Mm-hmm. Bran tells him it's time to clue John in on his true parentage.
We don't have time for pointless squabbles. Go tip over the map of Westeros, you know?
I know, Bran has no sympathy for anybody, but man, I feel so bad for Sam here. This is brutal, because I think he could have let his father go.
Right.
But it's Dickon.
Yeah.
It's Dickon. I gotta say his name.
It's Dickon
who
it's Dickon him over.
Really is sticking with him here.
Can't get over the Dickon.
He just, like, yeah, he's gonna be sad that his father's dead.
Uh-huh.
But not as sad as he is that his brother's dead, because his brother didn't hate him.
I thought John Bradley did a great job here.
Oh, hell
because
yeah.
Because as I was watching it, and knowing what was coming and seeing him react to the death of his father, I'm like, I'm actually not sure how Sam would react. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like I feel like I'm a good friend of his, but like, who knows how you'd react to the death of your father. No. And I felt like it just felt real. And then you knew also as soon as he started saying, well, at least I'll be welcome home, that like, you know, the look on Dane, like it's also, I thought Emilia Clarke did a pretty good job of playing this like very awkward, mm-hmm. While it's almost like anytime you see like a president or world leader being yelled at by like the mother of a dead soldier, it's like that's an extremely awkward thing. But part of being a leader is dealing with shit like that. And I thought, you know, I think actually she could have done a lot better. But it's like, what do you do when you say?
I think she's doing some really great work in this episode.
I'm not saying I'm saying as Danny as a leader, could have been a little bit more human and a little less like. Well, shit, I guess I killed your family by my hand. Everyone told me not to.
Yeah, I think this is why I think Emilia Clarke is doing such a good job, is because I'm not certain at all times where Dany stands. Like, she's clearly got some lust for power.
Right.
I mean, she wants to be queen. I'm the rightful queen at every opportunity she gets.
That's probably what she would consider altruistic reasons.
For sure, yeah. But that's a craving for power, which is always a dangerous, scary thing. And Emilia Clarke is like playing this line between like, I need to get the North on my side, but also I'm the fucking queen and they need to get in line. Like, there's a tension there between those two things, and she is playing it just right on that line. And I think she's doing a great job. And John Bradley, like, they're maybe the two most compelling actors in this episode for me. Because we haven't seen Sam do this kind of work.
Can we talk about... So this is to set up a contrast, because Sam's going to go tell John about his heritage at the behest of Bran. And so John has the natural defense of, look, I've also executed men who were insubordinate, who disobeyed me. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between what Danny did and what John did? Because if it's just because one guy's got burnt by fire and the other guy's got a beheading, I'm calling bullshit.
Yeah, no, I think there's not much of a distinction to be made.
This really bothered me, so I spent a lot of time trying to think about it, and here's the best case I got.
Okay.
Janos Slynt is who we're talking about here.
Fuck
Janos
this
Slynt
guy.
Was a corrupt, weaselly... He accepted bribes. He put out. He gave away positions of importance for money. He put the people's safety at risk. He is like fundamentally a dishonest, craven character. Mm-hmm. So when John gave him a second chance of like, okay, you can prove me wrong, and the guy tells him basically, "Fuck you! I have powerful friends that I've bought," and then John's like, "Fetch me the block." Randall Tarley, say what you will about him as a father and husband and all that, but like, everyone considers him to be a fairly moral, just, honest person, and the reason he's not refusing to bow to Danny is probably legitimate. Like, he remembers the Mad King and all that kind of stuff. So I feel like that's the only difference. Like, the character of Randall is such that maybe you keep him a prisoner and give him a couple weeks to consider. Mm-hmm. And certainly don't kill his son for standing up for a father. Like, that seems like fucking Danny would do the same thing. Like, she is kind of defending the memory of the Mad King. So, like, yeah. it's there's a level of hypocrisy and, like, the difference in moral standing of the characters who are being executed. But it's also a really fine point to argue.
It is, and that's always been kind of the hallmark of Dani, right? Yeah. Is that she's figuring her way out, figuring her way through this shit as she goes. She doesn't have any good answers. She started off as just a kid. Like, she's learning.
I hope she gets articulate, because I hope John confronts her about some of this stuff, and I hope she's able to articulate a defense that's not some imperious Dani, I'm a queen bullshit.
Right. Yeah, because that, like, honestly, that means nothing to me.
Right. Like, it would mean less to John.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was a king. Yeah.
Turns out I actually still am a king.
Yeah, I'm actually your boss.
Yeah. Okay, so Sam goes to the crypts, where he finds John and asks if he would have killed his family as Dani did if he were king, which he rightfully should be. John's confused until Sam tells him who his parents are, which really confuses him because it means he's his honorable father lied to him for his entire life. And we've kind of talked about a big chunk of this scene already. Yeah. But yeah, it is, like, this is a super important scene. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest conflict driver for the entire final season,
yeah,
is what I guess.
Other than Night King and Cersei, yeah,
the big battles, but, like, character wise, sure. and you know, the Game of Thrones,
yeah,
like, this is the biggest conflict driver, and I'm excited to see how it plays out, honestly.
And also, I think Sam, like, you know, his strongest point is you gave up your crown to save your people, which she'd do the same. That's an open question because we've never seen Dani have to do that. Mm-hmm. Like, she's always either through treachery. Or in the case of the you know, slave owners of, was it Marine Astapor or Court? One of those.
Can't remember, yeah.
One of those slave cities, either through deceit, treachery, or outright show of strength, she's won every battle. She's never had to put her crown on the line. Mm-hmm. John did, and we saw the decision he made. So the thing is like, yeah, I don't see how you simulate that. You know, it's like, well, would you give up the crown? Oh, sure, I would. We'll do it then. Okay, the crown's yours. All right, I was just testing you. Like, what?
Right.
You know, like, yeah. How are they going to resolve this conflict in a way that's not ridiculous?
Well, the thing that I love is the tension it sets up with the Northerners.
Yes. Because, again, yeah, I think it's not going to be Dani and John sideways at each other. I think it's like, how do we do this?
How do we make this work for everybody?
Yeah.
And here's the other important thing. So a lot of people are calling Sam out as, like, personally vindictive in this scene, going to John immediately and saying, you should be the king because fuck Dani, she killed my father and brother.
Yeah.
I don't buy that at all. Here,
me either.
Here's why I think it's crucial.
It's a fair
Sam,
first reading of the scene, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I agree. Here's why I think it's crucial that Sam actually tells John, mm-hmm. and shows that he's actually kind of pissed about this, uh-huh. And asks this question, would you have done the same? He's now playing with all his cards on the table. John can't come to him and say, well, I found out that she killed your father and brother, and, like, I'm pissed about that. You must be pissed. Were you playing me? Like, mm-hmm. were you hiding this from me intentionally? No,
yeah.
Everything's on the table. Mm-hmm. John just now has to do with it what he will.
Plus,
and
crucially,
that's important.
It's not like Sam ran down to the crypts in some kind of mean girl way, like, oh, look what Dani wrote in her burn book. It was like, he was hurt and angry. He ran into Bran, and Bran said, now is the time.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
think Sam would have chosen to go down there and confront him like that half-cocked, except for Bran pushed him to do it. So there's the ultimate. It wasn't Sam's idea. Like, I think Sam would have mm-hmm. kept on. The reason he was hiding from John correctly deduced it, is because he isn't good at keeping secrets, and he's got a big one from John, so he's avoiding him. I think he would have just continued to do that. Mm-hmm. So, I don't think Sam's got a... got a duplicitous bone in his body.
I'm with you. All right, so we go to Beric and Tormund, skulking around Last Hearth until they run into Dolores Ed. Dolores? I don't know how to pronounce it. Who shows them what he's found, which is a grisly message from the Night King. They realize that they might be able to make Winterfell on horseback before the Night King does, but before they can finish planning that, the message comes to life, and they have to set it on fire before it murders them.
Mm-hmm.
The message being a spiral of body parts around Lord Umber.
Yeah,
oh,
the late Lord
fucked
Umber.
Fucked up, this image.
It is wild. The making of special, they actually had a dwarf or little person actor that they put a realistic face of the kid on, and they set him on fire for like 10 seconds.
What?
Yeah.
Why would you do that? Animatronics, man.
I would think that's what I was thinking, but, you know, stunt guys got to eat too, and it seemed like a good time was
had
by
all. How can you eat
all.
When your lips are burnt off? That's what I want to know.
They can safely set people on fire now. I mean, they've had this technology for years, but
For sure, yeah.
It still doesn't
seem safe.
I was thinking because like they have this guy hung up, and they're okay on like, you know, 1, 2, 3, you're gonna light a Barrick's blade, and then 1, 2, 3, he's going to touch you with it, and on 3, you stab him, and then we're gonna count to 10, and then put you out. So the guy goes on fire, and you just hear the director screaming, 1, 2, and I'm thinking, yeah, like, if you're inside that suit burning, it's got to feel like the longest 10 seconds. But they interviewed a guy, he's like, actually, I saw, like, the barest flicks of red through my, like, viewport or whatever. It's like, when they put me out, the first thing I asked was, like, did I catch fire?
Did you get it?
Yeah. So I guess that's how good the technology works.
Wow, damn.
But it looked horrifying.
Yeah.
A lot of people wrote in to point out, and Cecily, actually, the night we watched this, she came home, and we have a couple of these, like, Targaryen medallions, and she had one on her desk, and she says, doesn't this look like the symbol? It's like, you know, they have this spiral motif, but also it's undeniably looks a lot like the Targaryen sigil
of
the three-headed dragons and their tails and their wings, and they're all kind of in that similar spiral.
Yeah.
It's tough to say because the White Walkers do this spiral stuff. We saw that in the caves of Dragonstone. We've seen them do this with body parts before. Is this actually, though, a message aimed at, like, the Mother of Dragons? Like, we're coming for you, Mrs. Targaryen.
We've never really known what that message has meant, you know, even from the beginning.
Right.
The spiral is sort of enigmatic. So maybe. Maybe, but I don't know.
It was grisly. It was one of the more straight up horror house things we've seen in this show.
For sure. And then we get the final scene where a cloaked figure rides into Winterfell and reveals himself as Jaime Lannister. Unfortunately, before he can even settle in, he runs smack face into the omniscient very scary and hopefully not vengeful Bran.
I hope he's vengeful. I want to put Jaime through the ringer. I want everyone to remember.
There's no way.
He threw this cute kid out the window.
We are definitely not going to get a holding a grudge scene with Bran and Jaime. Jaime might be terrified that's the case, or at least a little bit nervous, but Bran doesn't care anymore.
I don't know. Why would he be out there waiting for him otherwise?
Clearly, in my mind, there's something important for Jaime to do.
It's also possible that, like, Bran knows that if he just wanders into camp and is apprehended by Dany, that things could go poorly.
Since this
is the Kingslayer, and we know which king he slayed. So I'm wondering if they're wanting us to think that this is going to be some kind of grudge match, but I wonder if it's more of, like, I wanted to intercept you so that we can do this properly. Because, like, I know we just talked about how there's very little evidence, direct evidence, that Bran can foresee the future.
Yeah.
But, like, there is a little bit of me that thinks that maybe he's a Doctor Strange kind of, I've seen 14 million possibilities and we only win in one. And he's, like, maneuvering all these weird plays that seem like it's making things worse, or they're a distraction from the actual wars at hand, is actually him navigating the timeline or what the sequence of events to directly oppose the Night King and bring all these things together. It would be super sick and satisfying if that is a point we realize organically 2, 3, 4 episodes from now.
Well, there's... So, you know, in our world, there's this idea that history repeats itself, right?
I've heard that.
So it could be that Bran can't see the future, but he can see the past so clearly
the patterns are so clear.
Right. The patterns are all stacking up in the same way, and he's able to sort of push things in a direction that might have averted the previous disasters.
Yeah.
Or the things that have gone wrong in the past. So, yeah, I mean, maybe it's not exactly as clear as I see the future.
It's wild. I watched the first half of the pilot when I was compiling feedback and working out my notes because I wanted to see this. But you compare Tyrion and Jaime's coloration this episode to their season one.
Yeah,
it's shocking. Especially there's I think they eventually darken Jaime's color scheme, but like from the original pilot that they canceled and reshot, there's a few scenes where he's like really fucking frosted blonde.
Yeah.
That's intentional, right? As they get further and further from the Lannister orbit.
I mean, everybody's doing that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Everybody, as winter has closed in and things have gotten grimmer, everybody's gotten darker.
The
Starks went from brown to black.
But Dany's still platinum blonde.
Hair color. Yeah.
But
she was wearing pure black for the longest time.
True. Do you think Jon's hair is going to start turning platinum?
Yes. I think when he realizes he's a Targaryen, that he will just revert. DNA at the DNA level,
the bleach
to a Targaryen. Yeah,
The bleach is strong. it's just striking how much different they look, just from a hair and makeup standpoint.
It is exciting to me to have Jamie up here because how the hell are the Northerners going to respond to him?
Or Dan, like everyone.
If you didn't need another wrinkle, here's another
fucking
wrinkle.
There's multiple reasons all these people have to hate him, and only maybe Brienne. Well, definitely Brienne would
speak
in his
behalf.
Up here.
He's going to make Tyrion look like a fool, who's an advisor to Dany, right? Because he's going to drop the bomb that Cersei's not coming up here to help you.
Yeah, where are the rest of you, brother?
Right.
Yeah.
So nothing is good for this whole scenario. Like this... I expect episode 2 to be a real banger when it comes to like figuring out their shit in Winterfell.
Yeah.
There are going to be arguments on all sides. Blood might be shed. I don't know. Because we got to get to some kind of understanding before the Night King gets there.
And
fucked.
And we're on a definite clock with that because, as Tormund said, you know, they're halfway between the last hearth and Winterfell. Mm-hmm. So that's not a lot of time.
Yeah. You think old Beric could be the determining factor in Winterfell with his fire sword.
I don't know.
His potential.
It's the thing is like it seems like it's really crucial that they give that warning, but I don't. It makes sense for them to think that, but I actually think from a purely kind of like omniscient narrator, I don't standpoint. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because they know that the wall's been breached and the dead's advancing. So like maybe they don't know if it's tomorrow, the next day, the next day, but like. I would have to assume that they've got scouts and outriders and they're also just on a war footing. Like as soon as we can go to war, we're going to go to war. So like, I don't know what the warning would give them other than, you know, the exact date and time, which I guess that's valuable.
Yeah.
Today's sponsor is Arrow. Life is too short for bad Wi-Fi. And you know what, Jim? The single router model just doesn't work for our increasingly high bandwidth world. It's physics. I don't know if you know that. This electromagnetic radiation that we use to communicate invisibly, magically, in our homes is actually just like a form of light.
I use the Weirwood Wi-Fi network.
Do you?
Yeah.
Well, so. all I know is you can't ask a light bulb in your living room to light up your bedroom because there's walls and
That's
there's
fair.
Material in the way. And those things also get in the way of the other invisible light, the Wi-Fi signals. It's especially bad in my house because I live in like a 90-year-old house that has really thick plaster walls and masonry, and I have a devil of a time getting all those dead spots out of my house. What you need and what I need is a distributed system. This is what offices had for years at considerable work and expense. They build a mesh network that has multiple devices providing overlapping coverage. With Arrow, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your house in just a few minutes. And they're not joking. This is a true story. Today, before I went to record this Game of Thrones podcast, I had about 15 minutes to kill before I walked out of the room. And I saw that I had this evaluation router. And I'm like, I'll open it up and read the manual. 9 minutes later, I had the thing installed and configured. When I saw that it was just a card that had three steps and the most complicated was downloading an app, I'm like, awesome. I was able to do that with like six clicks on my thumb and naming the network, giving a password, and I was good to go. What's your experience with
It's super easy. So I also have the problem of like I have my office set up in the basement, and then I also want Wi-Fi in my bedroom, which is on the opposite side of the house and upstairs. Mm. So my router has never quite worked super well in the bedroom.
The earth is a fantastic shield for Wi-Fi signal.
It turns out, yeah. I set this thing up. It took less than 10 minutes. I mean, and that's including like one misplacement of the beacon because the process I really like, when you download the app, it walks you through everything step by step. And one of those steps, which has always confounded me in the past, is getting the extender connected to the base station, which in their terms is the beacon. That's the extender. And this, so I've tried to place it near the bedroom thinking, okay, well, I'll get good reception there. But they have the system set up so that you realize, okay, well, I got to set it kind of halfway to the point where I actually want it. And they walk you through that whole process. It told me, no, that's not good enough. Actually move it about halfway to where you really want it and do this test again. And it was super easy.
In addition to its ease of use, Arrow's home Wi-Fi system also features Arrow Plus, software giving you the ability to block malicious and unwanted content from your entire network. Plus prevents you from accidentally visiting malicious sites, blocks annoying and intrusive ads, and automatically tags sites that contain violent, illegal, or adult content so you can choose what your kids can and cannot visit. So
that's cool, because that process sucks on a regular router.
Yeah, like I said, I when I moved in his house, I had these problems, and I solved it by kind, because I'm was in another life an IT professional, so right. I did the research, I bought the routers, I got the extenders, I did kind of stuff. It did not take me only 9 minutes, and it still is a worse solution than the Aero and Aero Plus system. So if you want to join Gemini and never have to think about your Wi-Fi again, you can get $100 off the Aero base unit and 2 beacons package, plus 1 year of Aero Plus by visiting aero.com/GOT and entering promo code GOT at checkout. That's Aero, Aero.com/GOT and promo code GOT at checkout. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible, and Audible's been one of our oldest, most frequent sponsors, and we appreciate their loyalty. Audible is, of course, a leading provider of digital premium spoken audio information entertainment on the internet. Their content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks and other audio products. Membership to Audible includes 1 free audiobook a month, exclusive sales, and 30% off all their regularly priced audiobooks. Plus, all unused credits roll over to the next month. And if you don't like an audiobook, you can exchange it with no hassle. Unlike streaming or rental services, with Audible, you own your books, even if you cancel. The Audible app is available on all major platforms and provides a variety of features that I personally enjoy, such as speed control. I can listen to the narration faster or slower, whatever speed suits me personally. Also, I enjoy their integration with WhisperSync for voice, which allows me to switch between reading and listening to the audiobook across many different devices, including Amazon's Kindle and Echo, without ever losing my place or missing a word. And hey, you're listening to a Game of Thrones podcast, so you might be interested to know that Audible has the entire catalog of Song of Ice and Fire works, including George's latest, The Fire and Blood, Volume 1, a very detailed history of the Targaryen Empire.
What if I'm not a fantasy guy? Could I go sci-fi? Could I go with, like, Game of Thrones in space, The Expanse?
I will not only allow it, but encourage it.
Okay. Yeah, check out book one of that. I actually listened to all of these on Audible. Leviathan Wakes is the first one in that series, and that is really just a superb show and a superb series of books.
Yeah, it's good as Game of Thrones is kind of winding down, we have something as good as Expanse kind of winding up, and, you know, not coincidentally, we have podcast coverage of that show as well. But hey, this is all about Audible, and you can start listening with a 30-day Audible trial right now and get your first audiobook plus 2 Audible originals free. Visit audible.com/GOT or text GOT to 500-500. That's audible.com/GOT or text GOT to 500-500.
That's it. That's it for the episode.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character, Furiosa. Starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role, and the mighty Thor, Chris Hemsworth, as the warlord, Dr. Dementis, Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with.
Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We have feedback.
We do?
We have so much feedback. I'm going to read a small fraction of the feedback we get.
Okay.
Which is still a healthy amount, as you'll see. You can send this feedback to gameofthrones@baldmove.com. If we didn't read your email, it's because we got a bunch of them. Also, we have a bunch that I've saved for the spoiler edition that comes out this Friday. So you still have time to get it in for that. Plus, we already have a good amount of feedback for that one, too. Anyway, gameofthrones@baldmove.com. Or you can talk to your fellow fans on the forums at forums.baldmove.com. Here we go. Melanie, since the Lord of Light seems to allow people to be brought back to life in what feels like a very calculated way, I believe something was mentioned about Beric Dondarrion must have some unfinished business if the Lord of Light was keeping him alive. Do you think that once their role is completed, and she's referring to Beric and Jon Snow here, those brought back by the Lord of Light will drop dead the way the Whites drop dead, respectively, when their personal White Walker is defeated?
Good question. I don't know the answer. It doesn't seem like John has changed much, but could be the Lord of Light just keeping him going.
I mean, I don't think there's much direct evidence that you can say either way. Martin himself has said that he thinks that, like, John and Beric, well, Beric for sure, maybe,
Well, okay, so Thoros is dead, right?
No. Thoros is alive. Wait, he might have died. Did he die last season?
I think he died at the end of last season. When they were up in the north. And Beric's still kicking.
Mm-hmm.
Thoros is the guy who brought him back, right?
True, but she's saying, like, if their purpose is fulfilled, would they cease to be animated? And I guess I was trying to say, like, so my point was that George says that they're like, these are all Whites. You got Fire Whites and you got Ice Whites. So the question you got to ask is, does the mechanism of them differ? Because the one thing you also, they're different between the two types of Whites, is it seems like the Ice Whites are largely mindless.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any will that kind of animates themselves.
And it's not finishing their purpose that drops them dead.
Right. It's just the Night King leader beckons. Of them being like killed. They can literally sit there for hundreds of years in a frozen tundra and then erupt out of the ground when they need to, when the Night King calls them. Whereas mm-hmm. John obviously has a will and intelligence of his own. So. Mm-hmm.
They're very different.
Yeah.
I don't know how to even speculate on it.
I would guess that their purpose was fulfilled, they wouldn't just like be cut like marionette strings, but that would be pretty metal.
John jumps in a Superman stab and gets the Night King, and then he just crumples to the ground.
Or if they just outright win and him and Danny are rejoicing and then he just crumples to the ground.
They go to the waterfall and
that'd be pretty fucking metal though. All right, Karen. Someone asked how they count time in the Game of Thrones realm. You discussed where the year starting point would be, but I started thinking about what is a year on this planet. A year is how long our Earth takes to orbit our sun, but who knows the size of their planet or their sun or their orbit? So when all these characters are seemingly so young in the books, perhaps it just takes longer to get around the sun. Also, something is off with this planet and that winter only comes once in 1,000 years. So why do they call it winter then? Do they not have seasons?
I know we've talked about this.
Yes.
But I still couldn't answer this question.
Because
the show does not give a shit.
From George's mouth that there is no astrophysical reason that these seasons are wonky. It's a magical reason. So the maesters can count years based on how many times, because they can, you know, through celestial observations, et cetera, they have ways to count their years. And that's like, you know, like for example, Arya and Bran are multiple years old, yet you know, they're summer children. They've never known a winter before this one.
Yeah.
So there's lots of theories about why this is like this. Like, maybe there's one idea that I've seen and like is that before the White Walkers were invented by the children, it could be the Planetos, that seasons are relatively normal, and creating these kind of like these characters out of this ice magic imbalanced it. And then when they were vanquished, then you had these really long summers, and when they're active, you have these really long winters. But winter doesn't come once in 1,000 years. It comes semi-regularly every, you know, a couple years to like, there's been like I think a 15-year summer. It's one of the record long summers going into Game of Thrones. So they happen, and they're shorter, longer, but they're not the cataclysmic things that happen every few thousand years when the White Walkers return. But it's all, like, according to Martin, it's all magic. There's no astrophysical reason for the seasons to be the way they are. Moving on to Casey L., I'm getting some thought about Danny's Season 5 comment about breaking the wheel, which was revisited again by Tyrion in Season 7. I don't think the quote definitely means that she wants to do away with an inherited monarchy. If that's the case, then it's in direct opposition to all the other stuff she's been saying throughout the show's run. Most recent of which is that she was saying to Jon during the first meeting on Dragonstone, "I was born to rule the Seven Kingdoms, and I will." She doesn't want to get rid of the monarchy. She wants to get rid of the feudal system in Westeros, which is clear when you listen to the full quote. Lannister, Targaryen, Baratheon, Stark, Tyrell, they're just spokes on the wheel. This one's on top, then that one. On and on it spins, crushing those on the ground. I'm not going to stop the wheel. I'm going to break the wheel. So her objections lie in the devastation experienced by the common folk when these powerful families start making plays for power. These plays always result in violence because each family has their own army to compete with all the others. This is a staple of a feudal system for which the king parcels out pieces of property to lower lords in exchange for services, i.e. military support. So he's saying that they don't have any royal army, so it's the problem isn't with the monarchy, it's the fact that all these lords essentially have all the military might, and they kind of, the king rules essentially by their consent, and that Dany could maybe establish a royal army to go along with the royal fleet to end the wheel.
Okay. I feel like that's a bittersweet ending. That sounds awfully close to, I mean, in as much as a kingship, a monarchy is not a dictatorship. That sounds like a dictatorship.
But,
like, I don't want anybody else to contest my power, and therefore I'm going to break that wheel and just become the one true ruler.
Right, and it feels like it's just adding another step to another remove from the analysis, because, you know, you're saying that the people suffer when there's war, but canonically, usually there's war when people are suffering. When the king is a shitty king, the lords get the idea to depose them, and then you get war. There's also like civil wars within the Targaryen, but like those weren't as many as the individual squabbles between the Seven Kingdoms. So I feel like even with a national army, or a royal army, if Dany's kids are complete assholes and they mismanage it and people start starving, you're going to have war and they're going to be overthrown. So
yeah, she just doesn't think that she's going to rule that way.
There's just that,
to cause those problems, which is naive.
Yeah, the inherent problem of the monarchy is there's no way to peacefully transition power when the government is no longer serving the people.
Right.
You cross your fingers
and you hope that the next king is better.
Exactly. So again, you know, and I don't hide my bias. I'm very much for some sort of proto democracy in Westeros. Something I argue in my book. Spent a whole chapter on, but
godsofthrones.com.
Godsofthrones.com. But it's not something like I'm not going to be like, oh, damn, George didn't do. Like, I'm fully prepared to accept the conventional queenship or kingship too. Like, I'm not lashed to this idea. Charlotte R. Last night I finished my Game of Thrones rewatch and it got me thinking about the White Book. So the White Book is the deeds of the Kingsguard that the Lord Commander kind of maintains.
Okay.
They made a relatively big deal about
this. Was that the one that Jamie didn't have a page in?
Yes.
Okay.
They made a relatively big deal about this book in Season 4, where Joffrey was taunting Jamie about how brief his entry was.
Brief, right.
As much as I love the Brienne/Jamie relationship and don't want to see either of them die, I think it's inevitable that Jamie will, probably in some heroic way. I think the Brienne will then complete Jamie's entry in the White Book, explaining how his slaying of the Mad King was a noble act and restoring Jamie's story to be fitting for a noble and honorable member of the Kingsguard.
Okay.
I don't have much commentary other than I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Like, unlike the proto-democracy, I am officially married to this idea.
No, I like that because, you know, in as much as Brienne, you know, I had this theory like, okay, Brienne fittingly should end up with Jaime because she was made fun of and she, you know, now gets the most handsome man in all of Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
It would kind of almost make sense for her to want to rectify Jaime's reputation in that book, I think, mm-hmm. because her reputation was so shitty for a long time.
Yeah, and I can just see the scene. Like, I talked about in the preview podcast, like, it'd be cool if Dany had an all-female Queensguard, and, like, if mm-hmm. you had to guess, Brienne would probably be the lady commander, and just her, you know, turning to the book, and Jaime, he's the last Lord Commander, and you look at his entry, and it's bullshit. Barristan propaganda. Mm-hmm. I could see her, like, yeah, definitely filling out and adding context, and that would be pretty cool. It'd also give, like, that epic kind of, like, Lord of the Rings feeling when Frodo is finishing the red book and handing it to Sam to write the next chapter, like the idea that this is living, this is actually not made up, but it's real history. I like everything about that, Charlotte. Got to make it happen, double D's.
Yeah.
Reshoots. You got 5 weeks.
Time, yeah.
Get on it. Jesse K, why would the Iron Bank loan any Westerosi any money at this point? It seems like they should all be broke or nearly broke by now. Their fleets and cities keep getting destroyed. No one has any idea who's going to sit on an Iron Throne. The Iron Bank is set up to be this, well, ironclad institution, but it doesn't make much sense for them to loan to Stannis, and it doesn't make much sense for them to loan to Cersei. Where do they get all their cash if they're making these risky loans? Cersei's entire grip on power at this point is dependent on this one plot element.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong with that last statement. I mean, the Lannisters have a reputation. They always pay their debts, mm-hmm. right? This isn't just something they say. It's something that has happened. And we saw Cersei repay the debt.
Mm-hmm.
She did it with the gold that they took from the Lady Lena. So she's kept her word. Many, many times, Lannisters have kept their word with the Iron Bank. And I think that's why they're still leaning into that relationship.
Yeah, and like in real life, if you look at the stock market, you look at money indexes, the biggest returns are not in very safe, stable, developed countries that have very well-established transitions of power. They're all in developing nations where there is conflict and strife because that's where the biggest risk is. That's where the biggest opportunity. So it makes sense for the Iron Bank to continually bank all these squabbles that go on Westeros because the key thing about the Iron Bank is whoever wins, they can get their money from them because if they don't pay up, they just finance another person to overthrow them. At the end of the day, they're going to get to the bottom and someone will be king and they will owe them a lot of money and then they will make a huge, huge return on that investment. That's always worked that now, you know, the Long Night kind of like that's like the Great Depression. Like that's the part where the markets don't just get eight. I think that this is an unprecedented thing. Like they've been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years and there's never been this like Armageddon type thing that might wipe them out. But yeah, I think that's why they do it. It's
and I just
more
they don't
risk,
have
more reward.
They don't have a relationship with Dany.
Yeah.
So yeah, they could do things along the sidelines to support her. But I feel like.
Also, the reason they paid Cersei back is because she stole all – and the reason they loaned Cersei more money is because she stole all of the Tyrell gold and paid off all the crown's debts.
Right.
So she's like got A1 sterling credit at this point. Mm-hmm. And again, Iron Bank doesn't know there's a bunch of horrifying ice zombies that's going to fucking flip the table of Westeros over. So
do they know about the dragons?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
I thought that was part of Cersei's discussion with him.
Right.
Which you would think dragons would factor in. Maybe mm-hmm. that – you know, bumps your credit score up a little bit.
Right. Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, if the one thing that would really fuck the Iron Bank is if someone throws over Cersei that is not beholden to them at all.
Right, and that can't be overthrown easily, right? Like, you talk about that iron grip that she'd have with dragons at her behest. Well, what's the Iron Bank going to do to get their money out of a dead Cersei? Right.
But again, the Iron Bank being this ancient institution, like, absent ice zombie Armageddons, they can just play the long game
for sure.
And like, okay, 50 years from now when your grandson's on the throne and has shit away all your fortune and he's got like moths coming out of his pockets like some kind of old cartoon, he's gonna come and we're gonna fuck him but good on the interest rates because he's gonna be desperate. So They're playing the very long game.
Yeah, and like you said, this is a big bet for them, but it's also not their only bet. They've got their hands in many things. This is just one of them, and it has a potential to pay off huge, but it won't bankrupt them if it doesn't.
Right.
So, you know, this is an opportunity for them, and if this opportunity doesn't pan out, they'll find opportunities elsewhere in Danny's new organization that she sets up.
And real life institutions over leverage themselves and fail all the time.
That's true.
You might
be making a mistake
in our living memory, a international financial crisis where that just happened. So it could be that Iron Bank is just over leveraged and going to fuck himself.
Too big to fail, though. When Danny gets power, right. She'll have to bail out the Iron Bank.
Right. Hopefully, the dragons will shit gold, but All right, Letterbuck 2006 says, what do you think would be the most heartbreaking character in Game of Thrones to have to kill another character who has turned into a white? For example, character X has turned into white, character Y has to kill white character X, who's now trying to kill them. What's the most heartbreaking combination?
I feel like Sam is like number one on my list if he turns into a white.
Really?
And John has to kill him.
Ooh.
I'd feel real bad about that.
I think John, Arya, either way, it's pretty bad.
That's super bad.
Yeah. Hodor, I've heard a lot of people saying like seeing Hodor coming back on the battlefield would be pretty rough, but only for a very small amount of people.
Yeah, Bran, obviously.
Bran would be rough. Mm-hmm. Like
any of the Stark kids, I think.
Yeah, they grew up with him.
Yeah.
But like Brienne is just like, oh, it's just unusually portly and huge zombie coming at me.
Right. Is this the giants they talk about? They're not so big.
Exactly. Right. Right. All right. James H. As weird as it would feel to see Arya get in a romantic relationship with anyone, I feel like it'd be a nice narrative moment if the Stark Baratheon marriage Bobby B proposed with Ned between Sansa and Joffrey in season one is eventually fulfilled by Arya and Gendry. You have a daughter, I have a son, we'll join our houses. Still works. Yeah, no, that's another kind of like nod to season one. If they did get together, it would be... Now, I can't see a way that would actually unite the realm in some sort of peace.
No, unless
like Sansa, Jon, Dany... They're all dead.
Right.
And you're looking for like the Lady of the North and some kind of Son of the South to kind of come together. But it is a nice little... it's a nice little narrative rhyme. I like it. Andrew S., you guys mentioned that the Hound was on Arya's hit list, but when she played the game of lies, she kept telling Jaqen that she hated Clegane, and he kept on hitting her, saying that it was a lie.
Yeah.
Two separate things. Arya can still have the Hound on her list and be in denial about her hatred of him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that would actually be more tragic, the fact that she kills him and she doesn't even have, like, that same grudge anymore. I don't know. I think they could use that to show us like Arya's mental state, like Arya forgiving and moving past and realizing that Sandor is damaged in the exact same way that she's damaged. And look at how that's changed her. Like that would be a hopeful place if she survives to end with her character, because that implies that she can regain her humanity.
Does it invalidate the whole list? If she doesn't check every single name off this list, do you think she has to check any of them
if
off.
You die before you finish your bucket list, is it the bucket list invalid?
But she's not dead.
No, but I'm saying like, is like the concept of a list invalidated if you don't get to all the things, or if you change your mind about your priorities or something?
I don't know. Narratively, maybe.
Yeah.
But my life is, you know, maybe in retrospect a narrative, but not.
What's the other thing is interesting is that like, Yoren gave her the concept of this name that you say like a prayer for your bedtimes that she kind of adopted as like, you know, that's a sick psychopath thing that she learned from that particular mentor. And it's kind of that's kind of Arya's religion, you know, especially with the faceless men and all that kind of stuff. I think it would be interesting for her to find a new faith. You know, there's just several characters, examples of characters in the books, like Tyrion is, you know, a person that has no faith, but then he finds faith in Dany. Mm-hmm. Sandor is a person that doesn't have any faith, but then he finds faith in the simple faith of the people that are worshiping the Seven.
Yeah.
There's lots of those instances of redemption, of not maybe like purely religious faith, but like just faith in themselves, faith in humanity. And I think that would be a nice little sign that she's going to be okay. Jeremy N., we've been trained throughout the course of the show to care about the logistics of provisioning armies, but perhaps we shouldn't be so worried this time. If Danny's armies lose, everyone dies anyway, but if they win and defeat the others, won't they break the magic causing the winter and bring an early spring, allowing them to start planting much sooner than expected?
Perhaps, yeah. That's one possibility, the fallout of killing the Night King. But I don't know, the show is clearly at least mildly concerned with it. So
yeah.
Maybe it will be an issue.
I don't think that logistics have been a really important part of this show for several seasons.
Why bring it up? Like, if it's not a concern, is it just to appease some faction of the audience that is concerned about this sort of thing?
I think it's just letting Sansa play the political game, which is why it feels a little kind of like weak and out of place.
So she's less concerned about how we're going to feed these new armies and more concerned about like getting the jab in. Like,
yeah, she's trying to get hand in this
really,
relationship.
You should have told me about this and this
exactly.
is kind of fucked up.
Yeah, like, I didn't, I guess I'll set out a plate, but I really only made enough roast beef for the family. Kind of
pretty petty and shitty.
No, it's super passive aggressive, but that's kind of politics, right? Like getting like individual emotional and position and leverage advantages over people.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. You also got, like, Dany's army is, like, superhumanly... Like, I feel like the Unsullied would fight for, like, 2 weeks without losing any of their effectiveness, and they just keel over dead from starvation, you know? Like they can... Like, you've got an army that can kind of, like...
They'd cut their nipples off and eat them.
Yeah. Or, like, I mean, that would be fucking pretty grim, but, like, if you're talking about this... Like, cannibalism is kind of a thing in the winter in the north. Like, I don't know how brutal they're going to get, but like, if you're fighting to not be extinct, like, it's probably not too much to ask to butcher every fourth man to keep fighting. Like,
I mean, if they're just going to become whites anyway,
if nothing else, Bran has two perfectly succulent legs that he's not even using.
Jamie's got another hand. Let's take that.
He's got
that.
Another hand. Like, he can't, his left one. What's he going to do with that anyway?
He's no good with a sword.
You only need Tyrion's head. His rest of his body's
fair,
not that great in a fight.
His cock, maybe.
His cock, so
keep that around.
Stitch his cock to his neck, and then you. So there's ways to economize this and not be complete inhuman brutes about it.
Fair.
Okay. Edward R. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Cersei paying Bronn to go away. My guess is that she pays him to leave to either A, kill her brothers, which would be a bonus to her underlying the real reason to do it, which is B, get Bronn away from her so she can't he can't betray her. Because there's no way Bronn kills either Jaime or Tyrion, right?
I'm with you on that last thing. Is Cersei self-aware enough, or not self-aware, but is Cersei aware enough of the relationship between Jaime and Bronn to really think it's a problem?
Yeah, no, I think she's...
You think so?
Yeah, like it's like the Bronn's always been their man, and I could see her being distrustful of him. Here's the thing, though. The episode makes a big point about being Bronn's the only living man who's ever shot down a dragon.
Mm-hmm.
They're sending this man away with a crossbow. What could this man do with an obsidian tipped crossbow? And a zombie dragon.
Yeah.
Like, doesn't that feel like we talk about the rhyming narrative structure, and it's hard not to think about it because did you see the making of behind the thing? Because George Lucas visited the set for this episode.
I saw a screenshot or a picture of that.
And he was around, I guess, a big joke about, I mean, the joke on set for me would be like, what are you doing? You're really terrible at this particular part. Like, what are you critiquing performances, George? Get the fuck out of here. You want to polish our dialogue up? Is that what you want to do? But like,
saw a lot of sand memes and snow comparisons.
Right. But George is always, he's been big about like those kind of rhyming poetic structures and having Bronn almost take down a dragon and then actually take down one, I think would be a cool progression for him. Because otherwise, she's just sending him packing. Like, she's paying him in advance with a wagon full of gold. We'll never see Bronn in King's Landing again.
And hoping that he takes this mission up, and if not, oh well, but at least he's gone.
Right.
Yeah.
That's actually fairly smart for Cersei.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's actually Qyburn's plan. Like, if Qyburn is like, I got a pretty cushy job here. I got to keep this lady in power.
Mm-hmm.
He's like the real power behind the throne.
Could be.
Anyway. Oh, also, Edward wanted to know our percentage of likelihood that Cersei now has a UTI after messing around with Euron.
100%.
110%.
Yeah.
Mage dude, what are the odds that Cersei will go full Mad Queen and blow up King's Landing if she loses out on the war?
It's not zero. Mm-hmm. Like, I could see Cersei doing that. What means does she have of doing that?
That's what I'm thinking. Like, unless
the wildfire's gone.
Yeah.
Unless they've been restocking.
I bet they have more. I don't think she used the entire supply to blow up the Sept. But they have used a lot of it.
I mean, they used,
Battle of the Blackwater.
Yeah, and then Cersei blowing up the Sept. We don't know. We don't know if she has any more.
Also, who would be helping her? Because, like, before, is the Pyromancer guild? Would Qyburn blow up the whole city as, like, kind of a suicide thing? I don't know. I could see Qyburn being, a Queenslayer type. Because he seems like he's entirely rational. Like, he likes dabbling in his dark arts, but he's not insane, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah, he's fucked up in some ways, but insane,
he might be sociopathic, but not psychopathic, I don't think.
Yeah.
We'll see.
But I think Cersei could certainly try it if she has the means.
She would. It's not out of her character.
Not at all.
It's actually totally in her character. It's telling that we're just arguing the logistics of how she would actually do it.
Yeah. She's definitely going to do this, how?
How many barrels per hour can the mountain carry? She's out of cousins the cousin was trying to not set it off, so never mind.
Yeah.
How many orphans carrying a torch would she need? Matthew B. I found it interesting that Cersei is setting the stage for poetic justice by asking Bronn to kill Tyrion and Jaime with the same crossbow that killed her father. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's possible the same kind of ironic full circle will occur in the North when it comes to Jon? Back when Robb Stark led the Northern Army, he had all the momentum on his side and ultimately made the poor tactical decision of marrying Talisa against the advice of his family, following his passionate heart rather than his brain. John claims to be putting the North first, but could he follow in the footsteps of his adopted older brother by having love be the thing that leads him to being blindsided by his allies?
They're certainly flirting with that. I mean, Sansa basically asked that question this episode.
I mean, the thing is like, how pissed would the Northerners be if Talisa had the world's largest army and two full-grown dragons? Mm-hmm. It's more of like, you fucked us over by pissing off the Freys. You weakened our position just for the sake of your cock. Whereas John,
well, I think there's a built-in assumption when you're taking guesses on this topic that the North would not go along with it, right? That the North would not see Dany as their queen, and that they would see this as a further betrayal.
Yeah,
and so that would divide the forces, and you would lose the war.
But it's,
I think that's the assumption that's sort of built in.
But like Rob did something where he took he not only didn't bring anything to the table, he took things off the table.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Whereas John's like not really taking anything off the table except for the
North. But he might take
pride.
The North. Well, yeah. But he might take the North's forces. Like,
yeah.
Their support.
Yeah.
Which might be enough to turn that battle.
I was just trying to do analog it, or to try to make a 1-to-1 analogy between him and Rob, but. I don't know. I don't think there's enough time, honestly, to do that much complicated fucking around, because that would take us an episode or two to sell, I would think. And then what? The North is just going to kill John, like betray and kill John?
I don't see it happening, but I do think the crux of these next few episodes is going to be that resolution, you know, just the conflict in the North, who they're going to follow, who's going to be the king or the queen.
Yeah.
All that's going to be up in the air. And I think, you know, that's probably not going to be a part of it. There's probably not going to be this real question of like, oh, where do John's loyalties lie as far as like, oh, is he doing this for love or for the realm? I think he's much more a realm guy. It's pretty obvious.
Michelle D. Is anyone else bothered that there's no mention of Littlefinger's execution by any of the main characters? Even one line could have been enough between John and Sansa or Tyrion or Varys. Surely someone would have reacted. Honestly, I could have used a lot more. I could have used that scene between Tyrion and Varys over the, oh, it's so cold, my balls are freezing, you know.
Is that almost an indication that Littlefinger's face is coming back?
Why?
That they're ignoring it so hard? It seems such an obvious thing that needs to happen.
This show seems like it likes to lampshade and foreshadow more than it likes to conceal. But possibly. I mean, that's one. But I would like to have seen Varys and Tyrion's reaction.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of like, you know, that would be kind of their way to discuss it. But I don't know. It's also like, would you have to, like, you know, because they asked me if there's been another example of this. Like, I thought Barristan Selmy's death was cool, but like it really made zero impact on the story or the characters.
Yeah.
That's the one
that fighting in a hole.
Right. That's the one that it makes me think the most. It'd be cool to have like Jamie eulogize him as his mentor and they're probably the greatest swordsman he ever saw. Mm-hmm. But we didn't get that. And I don't know. Like I said, it'd been nice to steal 5 seconds of dragon flying time to do that.
Yeah.
Some ball jokes away. But what are you going to do? Thomas F. I thought this episode was mostly satisfying, but I'm really having trouble with something I feel is problematic as a plot device, which is Bran being an omniscient being. The most specific example of this relative to this episode would be the Lannister army. Bran himself is the one proclaiming, "We don't have time for this," with the imminent danger of the army of the dead. How would he also not convey to Jon, Dany, and company that there's no mobilization of Lannister forces coming north? Wouldn't this be key information for the upcoming battle?
This is the problem with omniscient beings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that they have a plan, right? Like, it's part of the plan, and then it works in mysterious ways, right? Like, Bran works in mysterious ways.
Mm-hmm.
He will tell you when you need to know. It's apparently not urgent because Bran hasn't brought it up yet.
Right.
Is how I'm looking at it.
Or Bran knows that no one of importance really believes the Lannisters are coming, so it's like... You know, like if he wheels in at 60 miles an hour to Sansa's reception hall, skids to a halt in front of her, and breathlessly says, "Sansa, the Lannister army's not coming." She would be like, "I don't need the Weirwood Network to tell me that, Bran."
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the best argument against. And also, I think they're very clear about the way Bran's omniscient works is it's like a TV that he has to tune into a channel.
Yeah, like, they are clear about that.
Yeah, like he knew some things about Jon, but he didn't know other things about the Septon's journal.
He could have seen that Septon writing in the journal. Right.
As soon as Sam suggested it, then we had the flashback indicating that then Bran could access all that information. But like, it's kind of like you have a device in your pocket, everyone that's listening to this podcast right now, that has the sum total of the world's knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know everything
right
in that? So like, I feel like the Weirwood net is that, like, it's an infinite. It's like the Hitchhiker's Guide. It's like the internet, but you have to know where and when to look, and it has to occur to you to think to look before you can know that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jeff R, can Bran see all the way in Essos? In the books, he sort of has a limitation of only seeing what a Weirwood can see, but there's talk of him one day learning how to see beyond that. Clearly, since he saw inside the Tower of Joy, he doesn't have that limitation now. I'm guessing Showbrand can see anything. I just had this thought of him needing to prove to Dany that he has the power to corroborate Jon's parentage, and then not being able to see what she did over the sea in Essos since there's no Weirwood trees, and then her not wanting to believe him. You've already gone on record of saying that you'd think that'd be annoying as fuck.
Yeah, I don't... like, that just doesn't seem like a necessary complication to introduce.
Yeah.
Just, like, have him actually prove it, you know? I don't know.
Plus, I think the Weirwoods are like training wheels for Green Seers. Like, they're the easiest ways to focus your power, but you don't...
Okay.
Like you don't need them once you're sufficiently powerful enough. Now, as a consequence of them kind of, I think, being shaky in the transition between the Three-Eyed Raven to Bran and what all that meant, like, we still... I mean, I would honestly be open to the fact that Bran is still kind of like Luke Skywalker in Empire Strikes Back. Powerful Jedi compared to like your average person, but like not at the level of like Darth Vader, the Emperor yet. Mm-hmm. Or I could believe that he's essentially Three-Eyed Raven powerful. I honestly don't know, and the show could go either way. And like, I think there's nothing that we can contradict either take at this point. Sean D. Although there hasn't been much, there hasn't seemed to be much fruit from the Greyjoy storyline of late. There's two thoughts I had. First, I thought it's pretty funny that Yara mentioned the Iron Islands like they could function something like Australia from the Game of Risk due to their isolated nature and White Walker's water thing. Yeah, you just sit on the Iron Islands.
You only get one inroad.
You take your two armies per turn, and you dare people to step into Indo.
And you eventually lose.
Ironosia.
You wait for your moment. You desperately try to expand into Asia. You get crushed by the person who holds North America between them and Europe, and you eventually lose. That's how that goes.
Yeah. Second, out of all the major families shown in Game of Thrones, the Greyjoy still have amongst the best alive to dead ratios. Theon, Yara, and Euron are all still kicking, so I'd imagine we'd still hear from them. I can't imagine Yara's going to just be on the sideline. They have her personally connected to a bunch of other players. I think you're wrong.
Yeah, I think she's out.
Although I could see like her Han Soloing like some fleet action at the end. That would kind of I'd buy that. Like she went back to Dairon Island, she got her house in order, and then she comes sailing with it. I don't know. That'd be a way to involve her.
I mean, how many boats does she have at this point? Although they can build 1,000 boats in like a week. So
that's right.
Who cares?
They have a 3D boat printing factory
apparently
that runs on salt and stone.
I'm just thinking, like, what forces does she have to mount again? Because like everybody is following Euron at this point, right?
And he just
so she goes back to the Iron Island. She has no army. She has no boats. What good is she going to do in Westeros against the Night King?
Literally, she's just the Australia on the risk board.
Yeah,
I
think she's just going to turtle up and the Australia of Westeros.
I wouldn't surprise this. It wouldn't surprise me to see her in like the last episode as some kind of like, you know, because they're going to be
like
some
if Theon
kind of
lives, some kind of homecoming.
Yeah,
I could
or
see
a funeral like, for him. Or like there's if Theon lives or dies, I could see because that's really the only person that gives a shit about him. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Jon forgave him, but like clearly he's not his favorite person in the world. So that's I think otherwise you already got way too many characters that you're going to have to winnow anyway. And that's all the feedback we have for this week. If you would like to send us more, if you'd like to run the Game of Thrones gauntlet, you can do so by sending a message through the SMTP protocol to gameofthrones@baldmove.com.
BRAN protocol.
The weirwood.net.
Yeah.
We also have our forums if you want to talk to your fellow fans. There's several rollicking threads going on right now at forums.baldmove.com. That's not it for our coverage of Game of Thrones this week. Nay. Verily, we have yet another podcast coming out this Friday where we talk about all the kind of stuff we haven't talked about. I know there's one particular topic that's somewhat prophetic in nature, has to do with the final disposition of people's lives that people are really wanting to talk about. We've talked about it many, many times in the previous, but you know, it's first time for everyone to listen to the podcast. We'll be talking about that thing that I've been putting off for a week or two to talk about in the spoiler edition, plus whatever you find folks want to talk about. That's it for today. Until Friday, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.